It's time for Twit. Harry McCracken, the technologizer's here, along with Patrick Beja from French Spin, Michael Nunez from Mashable. We'll ask everybody to please leave Elon alone. Google and its search project in China. We'll talk about Apple getting hacked in Australia. And what's the story with MoviePass? It's all coming up next on Twit.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit. This Week in Tech, episode 680, recorded Sunday, August 19th, 2018. Hacky hack hack. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Audible. For a free audiobook with a 30-day free trial, go to audible.com/twit or text twit to 500-500. And by Uber. To find out all the ways Uber is moving forward and to see the improvements they've made to the app, visit uber.com/movingforward. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Rate Shield Approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. It's a real game changer. Learn more and get started at rocketmortgage.com/twit2. And by Stamps.com. Buy and print real U.S. postage the instant you need it, right from your desk. To get our special offer, go to Stamps.com, click the microphone, and enter Twit. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the week's tech news with the premier journalists in technology today. People like the great Harry McCracken. He's a technology editor at Fast Company. We call him the Technologizer. Hey, how are you, Harry?
Hey, it's great to be here.
Always love seeing you, and you. I love it when you bring your beautiful wife, Marie, up. Hello,
you
Marie.
Usually will come with me.
It's always nice.
Share her hands.
Always nice. Thank you. Deputy tech editor for Mashable, Michael Nunez, is here in the Mashable offices, it looks like.
That's right. Yeah. Busted. I'm here.
You're at work.
Here and ready to go. That's right.
I'm sorry.
No. Never a dull moment. That's part of the job.
Made you come to work on a Sunday afternoon or evening. Man. Although I don't feel as bad for you as I do for Patrick Beja, FrenchSpin.com. He's not Patrick on the Twitter. He's joining us from just outside Helsinki, where it's like middle of the night, but the sun's still out.
Well, it's artificial light.
Oh.
I have those.
I've heard of that.
Yeah. Pretty handy.
Yeah,
it's 1 a.m. and when I'm on the show, it's the best reason to stay up late.
Thank you.
Except
for staying up.
You know, when the baby's crying, that's another good reason.
How's the baby? How old is the baby now?
He's 6 months, seven wow. months almost. So he's at a point where he is trying to crawl, not managing, so getting angry, teething, and also discovering object permanence. So he's panicking when we're not in the room. So one of those lovely times. But he's cute, so it's okay.
It's fun because until you're a parent, you don't know anything about things like object permanence. But then you learn, you know, the Piaget stages and the object permanence, and it's so much fun. He thinks that you're not there, you don't exist. I've been loving the pictures. Here's a great picture of Patrick and his 6-month-old.
Aww.
Isn't that
look how cute he is.
It looks like a Gerber baby.
He's been away for a few days, so looking at the picture, I'm going all misty.
Yeah.
Aww. A little baby food label fodder.
It really looks like the Gerber baby. Like you could use him on baby food. That's nice. That's from Patrick's Instagram. He's also not Patrick on the Instagram. So let's start with the week's news. Elon Musk in the news this week. And I don't really want to say anything except just leave Elon alone, folks. Poor guy's just been going through hell. Elon Musk, according to the New York Times, details excruciating personal toll of Tesla turmoil. Nice alliteration, New York Times. He says, this has been the most difficult and painful year of my career. It was excruciating. In this, he talks about working 120 hours a week. Is that even possible?
Just barely. I mean, that's 3 normal work weeks. So that's 3 times 8 hours a day.
That really means no sleep at all.
Well, you can take weekends off.
Oh, weekends.
If you work continuously from Monday to Friday.
Okay. he also admits to taking a little Ambien from time to time to sleep because he can't sleep. Maybe explaining the weird tweets. He scared. I mean, investors were a little nervous after this interview. They were also nervous after his tweet in which he said, "I've got money to take Tesla public, private." And it turned out the funding secured wasn't exactly true, but apparently it was investment by the Saudi government investment fund.
Isn't there some kind of rule that says he can't make these kinds of announcements over Twitter?
Oh, yeah. He's being investigated right now by the Securities and Exchange Commission because the stock price, he said, we're going to buy him back at $420 a share. Sounds like he's a stoner. But anyway, and all of a sudden, the stock price, which was at, what, 414 or something, went up. And he made lots of money and then didn't do it. And SEC says, dude, can we just say, let's just everybody stop tweeting right now. This is not ending well for anybody.
Well, for Elon Musk, certainly. I mean,
anybody.
When he started calling people pedophiles over the submarine thing, it was already a problem. Now, it seems like really I guess what he should stop doing, maybe stop tweeting.
That's all.
But also stop working 120 hours weeks. Yeah. That doesn't seem to be going well for him.
Stop giving interviews. Stop taking Ambien. Stop tweeting. There's my prescription. Kara Swisher wrote an opinion piece for the New York Times. Let me answer the question many are thinking. Is Elon crazy? She says, no, he's a human being. And you know what? Elon has said things like, look, there are only two companies in America that didn't go bankrupt, two auto companies, Ford and Tesla. He's making a car that many agree the Tesla Model 3 is the best electric car ever made. It would go a long way, Elon, if you just, kind of keep under the radar and be crazy like the rest of us in private.
I wonder why he wouldn't do that. Maybe he's just so tired that he can't tell.
He's too tired.
Well, it's pretty good. It's also a pretty good promotion too, right?
You think it's good promotion or is it bad promotion? Doesn't it make people nervous?
For a while, it was entertaining. Lately,
I think for a long while it was definitely entertaining. Yeah, as Harry said, I think only recently he seems to have like really veered off the rails, and it just like underscores this idea that there's very little upside to tweeting unless you're trying to just stir some trouble up and get people mad at you. Then I don't really see the purpose of going on to Twitter. You know, at this point, Twitter is just this cesspool of hate and trolls. And I think Elon Musk probably gets a little bit of entertainment out of that. But it's also, it's cost him a lot in the past couple of months. And I think that he's probably finally coming to this realization. But certainly it's keeping his name in the news, right?
But that's not necessary. I mean, maybe if you're Donald Trump, that's a good thing. But not if you're Elon Musk and you're trying to sell cars and reassure investors. And then what's this about Azalea getting lost in his house? And there's just too much weird stuff going on. This isn't good. We all have weird stuff going on, but we don't publicize it, right? Patrick, I know you've got weird things going on in your house, but you don't tell the world.
I don't publicize those. They're just pictures of cute babies. That's all I do.
Yes.
But no, I mean, honestly, for the past few years, he has been using social media in a very efficient way. I'm talking about Elon Musk now.
Yeah.
It's only in the past month that he's really gone from, this Tony Stark Iron Man character to, is he taking medicine he shouldn't be taking? And I think that's possible to correct. He's just been having trouble, I guess, for a month. But it doesn't mean that he can't use Twitter and social media in a positive way. Until then, it was keeping him in the news in the positive light. So I think it's possible. He's just been doing a bad job at it.
Yeah, I mean, I think, but where I draw the line is like this pedophilia stuff. There's been a lot of really erratic behavior in the past couple of months, and so we shouldn't just gloss over, some of his public behavior. I think that it really deserves holding this person accountable. I think the investors certainly deserve that much, and I think that even just like the general public, if you're going to be a billionaire and finance all of these really these really really big goals, I think that's great. I think that it's awesome that he's trying to privatize space. It's awesome that he's trying to develop all of these new technologies, including making the electric car more mainstream. But to call a rescuer a pedophile and to you know to do some of and also the attacks against the media, I think there's certain behavior that is just. It just crosses the line for me, and I start to lose faith in this person as a good leader, as someone that I look up to, and I start to just think of him as kind of a madman. You know, this is someone that's egotistical, narcissistic, and just ultimately thinks that he's always in the right, even when, you know, even when he doesn't deliver on some of his promises, because that's also been the case with a few of his companies at this point.
I have to say, first of all, Twitter is addictive. It's like crack. I can understand, you know, you just got a tweet. You just got a tweet in the middle of the night, whenever you got a tweet. It's also, as a media entity, this kind of behavior is addictive.
You think so?
It's hard not to cover it. I didn't want to cover it. I was going to say leave Elon alone and move on. But it's fascinating in weird ways. Kara Swisher writes in the New York Times, she says, people ask me all the time now, is Elon crazy? No, he's not. Not at least in my various encounters with him over nearly two decades, including recently, in which he has been alternately funny, rude, compelling, obnoxious, accessible, easy to deal with, hard to deal with, always on, outspoken to a fault, even when he might be at fault, angry, charming, intense, also strikingly confident, deeply human with all the positive and negative characteristics. I don't think that really answers the question. He gave a great interview, I thought, with Marques Brownlee on YouTube, but that was all about the Tesla and the factory, and it was that. Stick to that, Elon. You're doing great. And then there's this weird story, and I think this is just people hopping on the musician Azalea Banks on Instagram, posting a bunch of weird, increasingly odd posts about being trapped in his house. I waited around all weekend, she tweeted, while these have all been deleted, while Grimes coddled her boyfriend for being too stupid to know not to go on Twitter while on acid, which is completely possible that that's what's going on. I don't know. Staying at Elon Musk's house has been like a real-life episode of Get Out. His humanoid group emerged, crawled out of the Caucasus cave system 15,000 years ago after the first Caucasian Homo sapiens did. Now I don't know what's going on. And then pork skin was the last tweet. So I don't, it's just.
I mean, I think this is veering into, you know, People's Magazine.
It is worse than that. You know, yeah, sensationalism. Yeah. Yeah.
But he has been behaving erratically, and it shows on Twitter. But I think it's been dealt with in a, not dealt with, but the reaction, he didn't get a pass. Everyone has been very concerned by what he has been tweeting. Yes. That's right. And very likely for this latest stock price episode, he's going to be in serious, at least there are going to be legal questions. So I think it's happening the way it should be. And hopefully he will manage to get back to a normal behavior. And if he doesn't, we might write him off. But for now, things are going the way they should, I think.
Yeah.
If Twitter did not exist, would people be fascinated by Elon Musk, or would, like,
that's what I mean.
85% of the things that people find interesting about him just not be apparent to us?
Right.
And I completely agree.
It's like a double-edged sword. He got benefit from it, as you pointed out, Michael, but now it's not benefiting him, and I don't know.
Well, and also, I also wanted to just say that I don't think Elon Musk deserves that much praise at this point. You know, we still don't have our $30,000 electric car. We still don't have, you know, I think He goes on to Twitter and he makes these really big promises for all of the companies that he's running, but he often falls short of those promises. And I just don't see, you know, I think he deserves some credit for trying. That's certainly really great. That's a commendable, you know, commendable behavior from an entrepreneur. Okay, so he's trying to reach the moon. He's trying to reach Mars. He's trying to build an electric car that everyone can afford. The reality is he hasn't done any of those things, and so I think that we, you know, in addition to the erratic behavior,
those things are hard. You don't expect him to be on Mars tomorrow.
Yeah,
no, I don't.
But he hasn't. Done
he landed two rocket launchers in tandem, and he did some pretty good stuff.
Tesla and SpaceX are pretty impressive.
Yeah,
but he has fallen short of his own self-defined goals.
Go ahead, Patrick.
arguably, he's moved the entire auto industry into developing electric cars. And at the very least, his cars are reality, and what they do would have seemed unimaginable 10 years ago. Yeah. So I think it's a little bit unfair to say he has done nothing.
No, he's
delivered on all of his promises. No. But
no.
He has still, I think the most disappointing thing is that, as I was saying, he was this figure of hope, of like science triumphant, and the voluntarism of man triumphing over the difficult odds of nature. And now we're finding out he might be insane, which is a little bit disappointing, but you know, it's, the book is not written on him yet.
It's not too late.
Yeah, exactly.
I think Elon could recover if he just gets off Twitter now.
He doesn't seem insane. It's just that it's all out there.
Right. It's all out there. And that's one thing you maybe don't want.
And I can't understand why he's letting it all out there if he's under control of himself. But
well, he's under a lot of stress. He's working really hard. Also, don't forget, Elon thinks this is all a simulation. And right. If you're in a simulation, it doesn't really matter what you do, right? Have some fun. I think part of Elon's real courage, Jason Calacanis, who's a friend of his, did not want to speak for him, but was here a couple of weeks ago, said, you know, you got to understand, Elon was at one point not only flat broke, but owed hundreds of millions of dollars after he made all that money at PayPal, started SpaceX, started Tesla. He was deeply underwater and fought back and created something. And I think that if you have the kind of courage to you know, put it all on black, put it all on red, and just let it ride that Elon Musk has. It helps if you think it's all a simulation. It gives you some false courage. I admire the guy. I own a Tesla. I will buy another Tesla when this one, the lease runs out on this one. I think they're great cars. And okay, so my initial intent to say leave Elon alone, completely shot.
Not me. No, I refuse to leave Elon alone. I think, like, I'll give him credit for the batteries, but not much beyond that.
You know, it's really interesting. We had Sam Abulsamid on last week. He's a car guy, works for Navigant Research, and is kind of, it almost feels like he's like anti-Tesla, anti-Elon. Even in the, he hates the Tesla. And I think it's weird how Tesla especially, but Elon in general, but Tesla specifically, have created this weird polarizing thing where you love it or hate it, right? I don't. It's puzzling to me. It's unusual.
And on what grounds does he hate it?
I don't know. I keep trying to put him on the spot. He said, "Well, the fenders fall off." I mean, I don't know. But it's funny. Even in my own family, my wife hates our Tesla. She hates it every time she drives it. She said, "The thing tried to eat me. Tried to run into another car. It stopped in the middle of the freeway." And I haven't. I love it. I have, and it's the same experience probably for both of us, with just different takes on it. I don't know.
I mean, I would say it's hard to deny that the Tesla Model S is a really cool car. It's obviously pretty awesome, but I just think that a lot of the technology in that's going to be commodified over the next couple of years. You know, Tesla's big claim to
Tesla. Thanks to Tesla.
Well,
and I don't think Elon minds. He's basically given away a lot of his technology. He's giving away the self-driving stuff. He's open sourcing it. I think his goal is to save the world in a number of ways, solar, but also electric cars. And he wants everybody to succeed. And I think that's pretty awesome. But anyway, it's interesting. There's really, we do have, people have these kind of visceral takes. And maybe that's what it really is people feel strongly about it.
I'm like cautiously positive about the Tesla. I don't have one, so it's not a personal thing.
Everybody I know who has a Model 3, I wasn't going to get a Model 3. I was going to get somebody else's electric car. Everybody I know who has a Model 3 says, oh, you'd be crazy not to get one. It's the greatest car ever made. And
it feels like, sorry.
Go ahead.
It feels like Tesla is a brand that consumers have kind of a similar relationship to as people who like Apple.
Apple.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
So I don't know how much of it is actual preference for the objective qualities of the product and how much of it is some kind of irrational attachment to the brand because it makes you feel cool.
It is like an Apple very much in all of those respects.
And if you love something, you're willing to cut it some slack when things are not perfect.
Right. I always try to tell people, it's okay to love Apple, but don't assume Apple loves you. They're just a company. And I suppose I should say the same thing not Tesla. Google is struggling over this search in China project. Project Maven was the military drone project that its employees rebelled against. Google says, we're not going to do artificial intelligence for the army. Now they've got another project to bring search back to China after famously leaving China behind. They had an event, an all-hands meeting this week. Katie Conger was live tweeting it and shut the event down. But we, not before we heard that Sergey Brin said, I hadn't really heard about this. Sergey Brin said, Now, he's not the CEO. Dragonfly, that's the code name for this. Here's Katie's tweet. It came to my attention, honestly, because of all this kerfuffle. Kerfuffle. As soon as somebody in the audience noticed this, Casey Newton, writing for The Verge, somebody in the audience noticed this, he stood up at the microphone, said, F you, and told everybody there's somebody in the audience who is live tweeting these private remarks, and they shut the event down. But what is Google up to? That's the question. And remember, Sergey Brin grew up in the Soviet Union, is no fan of repressive authoritarian regimes. I thought in a quite principled way, decided to take Google's business out of China after they asked him. What, I can't remember what it was. Were they asking to help find dissidents or just censor? I think it was just censor search results.
Censorship, yeah.
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 And now they're talking about going back in with censored results?
It seems like someone was looking at China. I mean, obviously, we don't have specific knowledge about any of this, but from what we're gleaning, I would say someone in the company went, to their management and said, listen, let's just see how it could work if we could try to make a search engine for China just to see, to study it. And they told him, all right, do it, but don't tell Sergey. We'll see what happens once it's ready. We can discuss it then. That's what it feels like to me. They were prototyping it, maybe with the intention of discussing it later and see how it would work so that they could discuss it. And maybe someone had in the back of their mind, you know what, we really need to be in China. So that's a good way of trying to approach it cautiously.
Yeah, and there is, we don't know because this is all leaks, although leaks that aren't really denied by Google. But Google has apparently said, well, this was just in the early stages, but others have said it's ready to ship.
They said, Sundar Pichai said it would not be available soon, but soon could mean tomorrow, right. Soon could mean a year from now.
They are remarkably vague with all of this.
Let me ask this larger question then, and I'd be really curious what you all think. What responsibility do American companies have to stand up for American values overseas? Apple very famously is happy to do business in China. They say, well, we're just following the local laws, but let's admit the local laws are somewhat authoritarian. Apple, for instance, has moved all its iCloud data storage for Chinese nationals into China with companies that are run by the Chinese military, in effect handing over data about Chinese citizenry stored on iCloud to the Chinese government. That seems to me a line too far. Should Google have a search engine that censors uncomfortable information the Chinese government doesn't want its people to see? Or should they just step out of China? Is there so much money there that American companies can't turn their back on it? When do they have a moral responsibility to say, you know what? No amount of money can get us to do business with China.
It's a really complicated question. I think you can make legitimate arguments in either direction. I did admire Google for pulling out just because it is unusual for any company to do something that is ultimately a hit to their bottom line. If they come back, I think you can also make a case that an imperfect Google is better than no Google at all. It sounds like they are talking about having disclaimers on the search engine that would make it apparent to people that information is being withheld, which is certainly better than silently erasing stuff.
I remember being in China during the initial Uyghur revolt, the Uyghurs now being apparently incarcerated by the millions in China. They're a Muslim minority in China. During the original revolt, I was in China 2009 watching CNN, and CNN started reporting about the Uyghurs. It just went black. It went black for 3 minutes, and then it resumed. So it's not like the Chinese authorities want to hide the fact that they're censoring. So I don't know if saying this is censored is doing anything.
It's better than nothing.
I guess it's all you can hope to do. But that big chunk of black was a pretty clear signal. There's something going on that our government doesn't want us to see on CNN.
And the Great Firewall, although it's been a while, I think I was last in China in 2009 as well. And at that point, the Great Firewall was pretty imperfect.
Yeah.
And it let some stuff through and it's hid some stuff. But my understanding is it's gotten a lot more effective more recently.
Well, that's another example, though, of China going along with the, Apple going along with the Chinese regime. They blocked VPN apps. They pulled them out of the App Store in China so that you can't try to get around the Great Firewall. All right.
I think one of the considerations for tech companies, I mean, it might have been different. When did Google pull out? Was in 2009,
2010?
It was earlier than that.
Was it?
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
I think it's been about 10 years. Back then, it
could have, you know, they looked at it and they might have thought, well, you know, this, they didn't really think how long they were going to have to not be in China. 10 years later, this might go on forever. Are they forever going to abandon the Chinese market and abandon? I'm thinking about money, obviously. They might be missing out on 100 years worth of Chinese business because it doesn't seem like China is losing its grip on its population and intending to loosen the censorship. And there is the other, you know, you can make arguments on both sides, as Harry said. And there's also the argument that you should not decide for another population what is good for them, which is a very, you know, complicated argument in itself. But is it for Google to decide, well, we don't like China, so we're not going to serve them? It's the kind of thing, I think, where you commend them for taking a stand, but also understand them if they don't. I don't know if that makes sense, but
I guess it also depends on what Google's actions or Apple's actions or any company's actions mean. One thing maybe to censor, another thing to help arrest dissidents. Yahoo got in a lot of trouble because Yahoo Mail was used by the Chinese government to arrest dissidents.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was really reprehensible of Yahoo to hand that information over.
I don't see how Google can be in China in any way and not somehow get into that system as well. It seems impossible for them to not, you know, they have so much data. At some point, the Chinese government is going to go to them and ask for whatever data,
right,
you know, search or anything else. So if they do, they're going to get into that discussion as well.
Not just China. I might point out that the world is rapidly becoming more authoritarian. There's also Turkey under Erdogan. There's Egypt. There's lots of countries. And at some point, you undermine your economic footing if you say, well, we're not going to do business where it's authoritarian.
Yeah, I just don't see this self-imposed ban lasting. You know, I think it was commendable, like I said, because it was against their own business interests. But I just think that ultimately, if your goal is to vacuum up as much information as possible, you're going to want to get to the most populated country in the world. And so clearly, you know, there's a gigantic business incentive there. They have a new CEO. A lot of time has passed since the Umbrella Revolution and since the last kerfuffle between Google and the Chinese government. And I just expect the company to find its way into China, even if it never has a majority market share of searches, or even if it's a very small percentage of searches in that country. I think that they'll find a way to do it, and I don't think that they really owe anything to the human rights advocates. As much as I, you know, tend to align with those beliefs, I don't think that Google itself owes anything to anyone. That, you know, there are a lot of American companies that do business in China, that do business in a lot of sketchy places around the world, And that's just kind of, I just think that's the collateral damage of globalization, right? This is just how the world works. You know, we don't talk about ExxonMobil doing business abroad or, you know, some of the other Fortune 500 companies that have strong footholds in other places around the world. You know, we just happen to be harping on Google and Apple because, you know, because there's sort of a Silicon Valley backlash at this moment in time.
I would, if this weren't a tech show, I'd be going after the pharmaceutical companies, the Exxons of the world as well. But we're talking about tech companies on this show. I think it's time for American companies to stand up and say, these are the values we believe in. And we are not going to put profit ahead of those values.
But the values we believe in is capitalism, you know.
Well, if that's all you believe in, if all you believe in is profit, okay. That's, by the way, the statement that they are making. All we care about is profit.
I agree to an extent, but also I would think it makes me a little bit uncomfortable to say, even though I you know, in an ideal world, I would love for Apple and Google and all of the tech giants to say, no, sorry, we're not going to hand over information on dissidents, so we're just not going to do business in China. That being said, telling that it's the job of companies to take these kinds of moral stands seems a little bit weird, because in my mind, and maybe that's because I'm a dirty European socialist, it's the government's job to say which country, you know, if you put a ban on trade with a certain country because the government representing the people estimates this is too far, we don't want to encourage that behavior, you're not supposed to do business with them. That's one thing. And that process exists. It doesn't seem like... Yeah, it's complicated.
So if the U.S. doesn't issue sanctions on a country, then we should be free to operate in any way we want.
Well, Exxon never said that its mission statement was don't be evil.
Good point. Google may be abandoning that, but...
Google and to some degree Silicon Valley in general opens itself for more criticism here because they've always positioned themselves as being good for the world and enlightened.
So here's what China wants. Good article, probably worth reading for anybody listening after the show, from Foreign Affairs, Adam Siegel writing, "When China Rules the Web." He's talking about the fact that their current president, President Xi, is very much aware of the importance of the internet to Chinese economic future and very much wants to influence it. In Xi's words, "Cyber sovereignty represents the right of individual countries to independently choose their own path of cyber development, model of cyber regulation and internet public policies, and participate." But that's fine. Yeah, I guess every country could do that. But this is the one that worries me. "Participate in international cyberspace governance, on an equal footing. China envisions a world of national internets with government control justified by the sovereign rights of states, but it also wants to weaken the bottom-up private sector-led model of internet governments that here in the United States we've championed for many years. Beijing sees that as dominated by Western technology companies and civil society organizations. They want more say in what goes on, not just in the internet in China, but globally." That bothers me. That worries me.
I think they would say that, but it's our prerogative to
right.
No, well, yeah, to say, well, yeah, sorry, that's
you don't
not
get to.
How it works.
Yeah,
yeah.
Wait, why does that bother you, though? I mean, isn't
you
that
want
kind of
China
what's going
to
on?
Act aggressively to shape cyberspace at home and on the global change, global stage? I think that worries me.
I think the idea of cyber sovereignty kind of already exists. You know, there is
that
no
I understand. I have no problem with that.
Yeah.
They can do what they want within the borders of China, but if they want to influence global cyber policy, that bothers me. That worries me.
No, I think that's definitely a couple of bridges too far.
Yeah.
And
but this is
the
problem.
Ones, you know?
It's the camel's nose under the tent, right? You give them an inch, they take a mile. I sound like an old guy. And furthermore, a stitch in time saves nine. Hey, we're having fun. I'm glad you're here. Michael Nunez from Mashable. How are things at the new Mashable?
They're going well.
Good.
So we have new owners and same office. But everything's going pretty well.
I, of course, know Pete well, and we'll always have a soft spot in my heart for Mashable, all the friends who've gone through there. I want you guys to do well. So I'm glad to hear it's okay. Good to have you on, Michael. The technologizer, yep. Harry McCracken, has been around for a long time.
A long time.
He's technology editor at Fast Company and always a welcome guest. I wonder when Harry's first Twit appearance was. It's been a long time.
I believe it was just as I was segueing out of PC World.
That's right.
And so starting your own. 2007, maybe.
Yeah.
I remember at the time, every time I got a new Twitter follower, I'd get an email, and I was on Twit, and my email inbox broke up.
That was when you could still get an email for every new follower.
So then that must have been around 2007. Yeah. So 2007, yeah. I'd say.
We just crossed 14 years into the 14th year for Security Now, and I think we're in our 14th year for Twit. So actually,
wow.
That's not right, is it, Karsten? Because I think Twit's, when did we start? In April?
Yes.
Yeah. So April 2005. So we're in our 13th year, soon to be in our 14th year. Also with us, Patrick Beja, who's also a longtime friend of the show. Always great to have Patrick on. FrenchSpin.com. He does English language and French language shows. Yep. Out of his world headquarters in Helsinki. You figure it out. You know who else has been with us an awfully long time? Audible. I think Audible probably started advertising right at the very beginning. I know I started using Audible in 2000. So I've been an Audible subscriber longer than I've been doing Twit. That's because back in the old days, I had a commute from hell all the way down to San Francisco. And if it weren't for Audible, I would have probably gotten in a crash or road rage or something. Audible has saved me so many times. Audiobooks from Audible are pure enjoyment. I want you to take a look. Audible audiobooks are a great sidekick for whatever you're doing. Anytime you can't hold a book, whether you're hiking, sunbathing on the beach, cooking, walking the dog, and of course commuting, they have an unmatched selection. I've lost count. Unbelievable selection of audiobooks, but also original audio shows, news, comedy. Audible broadcasters, entertainers, magazines. You can now, the Audible app, if you haven't seen the Audible app in a while, you really ought to check it out. The Audible app has gotten so interesting because you can do clips, you can send clips or books to friends. They let you listen faster or slower. I know a lot of people listen to podcasts faster. You can speed it up if you want it, or if you slow it down if you want. And because Audible is owned by Amazon, when you buy a book on Audible, you can also buy the Kindle version. And then with WhisperSync, you can read it on the Kindle and then pick up where you left off on Audible and vice versa. I love WhisperSync. Audible members get credit for every month, good for any audiobook, regardless of price. Don't worry, unused credits roll over to the next month. If you don't like a book, no problem. Exchange it, no questions asked. Your books are yours to keep. In fact, that's one of the things I love the best when I go to my Audible library. Oops, it wants me to log in. I love it because I have... You know, a longtime Audible member. I have hundreds of books in my library. I can listen to at any time. It's like a real library. That was one of the problems I had with I used to listen to books on tape. Remember those days? You'd have to mail it back after a month. I never would even finish a book in a month. So what are you listening to these days on Audible? Let me give you some Audible recommendations. Anybody else? This is what I'm taking. We're going on a vacation to Europe. I decided to do a little Heinlein binge. I read Heinlein in high school. I haven't read it since then. Moon is a Harsh Mistress and Stranger in a Strange Land are coming with me. This new Stephen King, The Outsider. Lisa and I. So one of the things Lisa and I do is we will pick a book that we both want to listen to. And we'll listen together. And she loves the Stephen King. I do too. So we're listening.
Can I give a recommendation?
Yeah, Patrick Beja, what are you listening to?
So I listened when my wife Sonia was expecting. I listened to Bringing Up Bebe, which is Bringing Up Bebe. It's an American woman who went to Paris with her 2 or 3 year old and reflects on American and French ways of educating and raising babies. It's a really interesting for the education part, but also it's super funny, very well written. I had a blast listening to it. If you're expecting or have a small child, I highly recommend it. It's very enjoyable.
Actually, that's another good reason to have Audible. As your child ages, what becomes a reader, even if he or she, is it, what's his name?
Oh, my?
Yeah.
My child?
Yeah.
Oh, he's a little boy called Aeneas.
Oh, Aeneas.
Aeneas, yes.
Aeneas.
From, yeah.
Like Aeneas Nin? Aeneas?
Aeneas. It's from the Iliad.
Oh, basically. Aeneas.
Aeneas. Yes.
Good name.
Sorry, I don't know the English pronunciation.
Yeah, Aeneas. How did Aeneas die in the end? I think he was carried off on his shield. I might be wrong, but anyway.
No.
Let's not talk about that.
He escaped and ended up being.
He founded Rome?
Yeah, not himself, but
that was Romulus and Remus, the two wolf kids.
Yes, yeah. He's the ancestor of those.
I should read more Audible books. I'd know all about Aeneas.
There's a new version of the Iliad, actually, really interesting as well.
Oh, I've read it. I'm reading it. I love it. It's a new translation that's phenomenal. Yeah. Oh, you know what? This is the other thing I always do. I always look on Audible to see if the book I'm looking for is on here. Let's look for the Iliad.
Oh, I have it. I know it's available.
On Audible? Is this the Anthony Heald translation? Is that the new one? I've read Robert Fitzgerald's, which is a classic. I think this is the new one. Anyway, there is a new translation that... it's by a poet. It's by a female poet.
Carolyn Alexander.
That's it. She's a poet. Do go to Audible. Get a free audiobook with a 30-day free trial at audible.com/twit. Or you could text TWIT. This is the new way to do it. Text TWIT to 500-500. That's the short code, and they'll send you a link. AUDIBLE, audible.com/TWIT. Or text TWIT to 500-500. I am bringing about 30 books with me on my trip. I know I won't finish them all, but what I like is having them on my iPhone, especially on the long plane flight. It's like 15, 20 hours, and I can listen to a great book. So many good books at Audible. I'm really enjoying it. AUDIBLE.com/twit. Bebe. I should listen. Now, the Aeneid is also about Aeneas, right?
Yeah. It's his travel from Troy to basically what ends up being Rome. But it's not so... I mean, he Dido falls in love with him, and then he doesn't want her, and he commits suicide. It's all
a like little grim
Greek tragedy.
A little grim.
It's a little, but you know.
Okay.
But yes, it's about him as well.
Okay. I there it is. No, that's not it. Let me. I want to find the. Wow, there's a lot of versions of the Iliad on Audible. You could hear a lot of different. Some of them 54 minutes long. Some of them 16 hours long. You get to choose. I got it in book form, the new translation. I'm really admiring it. She really did a nice job. All right, let's get back to the tech news. Enough about audiobooks, although, gosh knows, we could spend a long time talking about them. What else happened this week? Apple is saying its buildings at its headquarters are only worth $200.
Some of them, not the whole thing.
The company is appealing the Santa Clara County tax collector, saying that a cluster of properties around Apple Park is just worth $200. Again, if you're a corporation in America, you can do anything as long as you're serving profit. Apple also had I don't know. Do I want to talk about the iPhone rumors? Should we talk about, is it appropriate? We're getting awfully close.
Just a few weeks now.
Yeah. I'm going to guess September 12th.
That seems to be the current
wisdom. Consensus?
Consensus.
So they don't want to have it the day after Labor Day because Apple doesn't like its employees to have to work through the holiday weekend. So it's not going to be the September the 4th. Labor Day is the 3rd. It's not going to be 9/11 probably, right? Because that would be sacrilegious. So what about the next day, Wednesday, September 12th? Yeah? Anybody got an invitation?
Right. Makes sense.
We won't.
Not that we can talk about, right?
Yeah, no. If you get the invitation, you get to publish that. I think. I don't think they make that.
Yeah, I think usually that's true.
NDA.
And it would be still a little while before those go out.
Usually a week or two ahead of time, right?
I think they send them out a little earlier than they once did, but not all that much time.
People probably complain because you had to book last minute tickets to get to New York. Will you go, Harry?
If invited, absolutely.
Yeah.
You never want to like assume anything, though.
No, and they have them now at the Steve Jobs Theater on the Apple campus.
The I think the last one a year ago was the first big event they had at the theater. Yeah,
yeah, that's an advantage for Apple because they don't have to telegraph their intent. They probably even could move it at the last minute if they felt like they weren't ready.
Yeah, they don't have to rent a space and that where it might leak.
The rumor right now is pretty strong from a variety of sources that there will be three new iPhones. One LCD to OLED. The sizes will range. The LCD version, about 6 inches. There'll be a smaller OLED 5.85, same size as the iPhone 10, and a giant 6.5-inch iPhone. What is it? 10S?
I don't know, 10 Plus?
10 Plus? Maybe 10 Plus. That sounds good, doesn't it? iPhone 10 Plus.
Although, will it be 11 Plus?
It goes to 11.
10S. So the rumor is 10S and 10S Plus.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Tennis. Anyone?
Tennis, yeah. And there's also the latest I read, I don't know how reputable the source is pencil compatibility.
Now that is bizarre, is it not? Weird.
Well, I mean, the Samsung Galaxy Note definitely has a following.
But it has a little pen that goes in the note. This would be a pencil that's bigger than the phone.
Maybe they'll do a mini pencil.
Oh, they could do one with a slot?
I mean, they're not...
Where the headphone jack used to be?
I don't think they're going to do that, but they might conceivably sell a smaller one as an accessory.
Yeah, they would have to, because it doesn't make sense to use that giant pencil with a...
But even then, it has so many implications in the OS. I think we would have seen that somewhere show up, some leak or something, because... You can't have a pen and not have a way to write full sentences on your phone.
That's a good
point. Or at least, one word at a time.
And there's no trace of it in iOS 12.
Exactly.
As of now. iOS 12, the public beta is at beta 6. The developer beta is also at beta 6, but it's called beta 7 for developers. And it's pretty stable. I've been using it.
I just did the latest update yesterday.
Yeah, just came out.
There are some quirks.
Still. But it's not, we got another few weeks. What will the selling price be, do you think? Are they going to raise the price?
I think the XS is going to be $9.99 and the XS Plus is going to be, $11.99. Yeah.
You agree, Michael?
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like they have no reason to. I feel like they have to test the limit of this pricing scheme. The iPhone X has done really well for the company. The revenue numbers have done particularly well at a really high price, and I think they'll push that boundary just a little bit. That's my expectation.
You'll be able to get half a terabyte if you feel like it, maybe.
So yeah, the Note 9 a bellwether for all this, because Samsung's new Note comes out at $1,000 for 128 gigs of storage and 6 gigs of RAM. Or is it 4 gigs? 6 gigs of RAM. And then the next step up is $1,250 for 512 gigs of storage. That's an awful lot of money. But
it's an awful lot of storage.
I guess.
I think the difference for Apple is they're going to keep the iPhone 8 in the store and push it probably, offer it for... Maybe give it a little bit more visibility than in the past, because that's a more reasonable price device to answer the concerns of you're going even further than $1,000. But the taboo has been broken already. So, and there's also the LCD version, right?
That'll be the low cost.
That's also going to be a little bit cheaper. Right. Yeah,
yeah. iPad. Will we see an iPad at the event?
Hope so. I mean, I think it's more than. Do that we got iPad Pro upgrades. It's been quite a while since anything significant happened.
Yeah.
It's the Face ID iPad, right?
That would be interesting. I have to say I have mixed feelings about Face ID. Fingerprint works so well.
I'm concerned about a notch on an iPad.
Notch. Where does the notch go? Does it go on the left? Do you have to hold it in portrait mode to log in?
A smartphone definitely has a primary orientation that's portrait. I feel like iPads, depending on what you're using them for, your primary orientation could be portrait or landscape.
It's mostly, you're on an iPad right now. Yeah. It's mostly landscape, like you have it, right?
For a lot of people, I think. But if you're using it more for reading stuff and don't have a keyboard, it can be a portrait device.
Yeah. Notches are just a scourge.
On the other hand,
they're everywhere now.
On the other hand, they could do Face ID, but not squeeze the screen quite as much.
Yeah.
I think that there were icons.
Yes, there were.
Somewhere in iOS, right? Yes. For a notched iPad. So
a big, a small bezel, notched.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. I think they're going to do it. They're just forging ahead. And just as strange as the notch is, people will get used to it. And even it, you know, it's very surprising how much of a fashion sense influence Apple has. The notch...
You see the notch everywhere.
It's weird, but you see it everywhere. It's kind of, even though it is not great aesthetically and for the screen, having a phone without a notch, and that's probably going to grow very fast, but having a phone without a notch feels like it's the old thing, right? Like, yours is the one without the thing that's new and that Apple has popularized. So I think they're just going to do it whether we like it or not, which is not uncommon for Apple. Yeah.
They moved the time over on my iPad already in the betas, so that they cleared space for a notch.
That's right. Yeah.
Oh, nice.
So the time's over on the left-hand side
I
now.
Saw that, too. There's nothing in the middle. There's completely room for the notch. They moved the time over. Google, apparently, with its Pixel 3s, will also have notches. You can't have more than three notches, though. According to this story, Google bans Android phones from having three or more notches. Good. I think that's good.
The notch wars.
I think we should hold on for no more than two notches.
I want a seven notch phone.
I thought for a while a notch was kind of an interim technology, that maybe that was just because they couldn't figure out how to do the cameras through the screen. That maybe someday we would have a phone with a fingerprint reader back again through the screen.
I mean, there are
cameras through the screens, but maybe not. Maybe we're just going to live with the notch. I would say don't get to like the notch too much. Hold out for a notchless phone.
Yeah, I'm still waiting for fingerprint scanners through the glass.
Like that. Yeah, the rumor
is... What happened to that? And also unbreakable glass. What happened to sapphire glass? Like people were buzzing about that years ago.
Apple got all those plants to make sapphire, and they ended up using sapphire on the watch, I think.
Someone has fingerprint scanning under the glass and spacing out on who?
Samsung, I think.
Or is that
they don't have it yet, but they have a patent for it.
Is it OnePlus?
Does somebody actually doing it?
The technology works.
There's something out there.
I think a parts manufacturer is already doing it. I'm not sure there's a... there is a phone. Maybe it's a prototype.
There's one or two.
I'm confused.
The first, here it is from Android Authority. The first underglass fingerprint sensor is here. It's from Vivo.
Oh, Vivo. No wonder we don't have them.
This is a Chinese Chinese phone manufacturer. According to this article in Android Authority, it's noticeably slower, taking 0.7 seconds to unlock. So maybe that's what happened is Apple said, we can do it, but it's not a good experience. Apple, because they have such control, they could decide, we'll release that later. We'll release it in October. They can do anything they want. So who knows? We're only guessing. We should say that.
I'm hoping that Face ID 2.0 is as much better over 1.0 as Touch ID.
What's wrong with Face ID? What does it need?
It doesn't work perfectly 100% of the time.
Sideways is a problem, and that would be an issue if you had a notch on the side.
The original version of Touch ID was fairly good, but not perfect. And version 2.0 got to a place where it basically worked super quick every time.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that Face ID, they have the same opportunity.
Apple is reassuring customers after an Australian report that a teenager, a 16-year-old from Melbourne, broke into Apple's system from his home many times over a year, downloaded 90 gigabytes of secure files. He apparently even said he got the secure stores where keys were stored. These sensitive documents, the police raided. Apple contacted the FBI, which then referred the matter to the Australian Federal Police. The AFP raided the boy's home. They took two laptops, a mobile phone, and a hard drive that matched the intrusion reported by Apple. It wasn't too hard to find the data. It was stored in a folder called Hacky Hack Hack. Hacky Hack Hack. And as often happens when you get caught doing this stuff, he couldn't resist boasting to friends on WhatsApp about what he had done. An Apple spokesman said the company's information security personnel, quote, discovered the unauthorized access, contained it, and contained it after he downloaded 90 gigabytes. That's not exactly instant. And reported the incident to law enforcement. We want to assure our customers at no point during this incident was their personal data compromised. So what was in that Hacky Hack Hack folder? We may never know.
We probably don't want to know.
Maybe we don't want to know.
I feel like, yeah, it's probably best that I don't know. You know, I'm actually surprised that Apple didn't offer this kid like an internship or something.
Come on. Like, I think the kid was disappointed that he didn't get offered an internship.
Yeah, I feel like you gotta throw him a bone. That's a pretty cool.
I thought this was the best way to get a job.
Yeah, it's a nice resume builder right there. I don't know. I'm kind of disappointed that they didn't offer him a little more, you know?
Hacky Hack Hack.
I mean, if he boasted to his friends on Snapchat that he did this, how likely is it that he didn't dump any file at all anywhere on the internet?
Yeah, no, good question.
He obviously knows what he's doing. I mean, his folder was named Hacky Hack Hack, so he's obviously a pro. But I mean, no, seriously, he probably frequents, you know, hacking forums and had to get informed on how to do this somewhere.
Yeah.
How do you break into Apple, download 90 gigs of data, and refrain yourself from posting at least some of it somewhere? I guess maybe he didn't, but it's surprising.
Although if it was encrypted, was it just sitting on his hard drive encrypted? Maybe. Mm.
Maybe. I mean, Apple may know that, in fact, it wasn't exfiltrated for, you know, I mean, there's ways to find that out, I guess, watching the guy's internet connection. He was at home, after all. He's 16, so we don't know his name, which is fine with me. I don't want to know. I would like to know his hacker name, though.
Hacky Hack Hack.
Hacky Hack Hack. One more Apple story. Apple's in trouble in Japan right now. Their Japanese Fair Trade Commission is investigating allegations that Apple forced Yahoo Japan to kill a game platform that it had that didn't require the App Store, bypassed the App Store. The Game Plus platform was launched July of last year. You could play games without needing to download apps. I didn't play any of these games, I don't think.
And it's Yahoo Japan, which is different and more important than Yahoo US.
That's right. It's not the same company.
It's still a big deal in Japan.
It was within the Yahoo app that you could download games. That's what Line does already, right?
Oh, that's right.
Curious.
They said it was web-based.
I'm curious what the difference is there.
Are they? Oh, it's web-based?
Web-based, maybe.
Yahoo.
Well, web-based, they have even less of a leg to stand on if it's web-based.
The Fair Trade Commission and the Industry Ministry began receiving, this is from the Nikkei Asian Review, began receiving reports from Yahoo last fall about issues surrounding its Game Plus platform. It let users play games without needing to download apps. That's all it says here. Yahoo abruptly slashed its budget for Game Plus last fall and now has all but stopped promoting the service. Yahoo told multiple business partners it was forced to cut back because of pressure behind the scenes from Apple. The company relies on the U.S. tech giant for part of its profits in the form of sales through the App Store. Interesting. We'll keep an eye on that story. All right, let's take a break, and then we're going to talk about Google following you around, whether you like it or not, and they actually, as a result, did we talk about that last week, or was that on Twig? It was Twig. And as a result, Google has changed its location tracking policy and language. and a lot more coming up in just a bit. Our show today brought to you by Uber. Actually, often in more ways than one. Often our hosts are brought to you by Uber as well. I certainly ride Uber around. You know, when Abby got in her last car accident, nobody was hurt. She wasn't hurt. The car was totaled. I said, Abby, I'm. You know what? It's cheaper for you to ride Uber. So I set up Uber on her phone. I said, I'll pay for this. It's a lot cheaper than me. She's still in college. Paying for a car, paying for insurance, paying for gas. And I love it. She loves it. Uber is moving forward, and they're doing it with a bunch of features for riders. She really likes the fact that she can see who her driver is. You can actually put notes in the app saying, I'm wearing a red shirt or a baseball hat. You can even choose a color in the app to light up your phone screen and hold it up as more and more people use Ubers, especially like in a big city on a crowded corner. I've had this problem, you know, it's me, that's my Uber. You can now hold up a red phone so that the driver could spot you at night or in a crowd. Just a few of the new features Uber's added to the app. They want to improve the ride-sharing experience for riders and drivers, and they want you to come back. I've been using Uber for a long time. I haven't stopped, and I still use it all the time. Uber.com/movingforward if you want to see what Uber is doing to make rides easier, to make it easier to get a ride, to learn more about your driver ahead of time. I think a lot of credit to Dara, their new CEO, who has really transformed the company. I am a fan, and I think you should be too. To find out all the ways Uber is moving forward, to see the improvements they've made to the app, go to Uber, uber.com/movingforward. uber.com/movingforward. Uber is headed in a new direction, and we thank them for their support of This Week in Tech. Before we get to the Google thing, does anybody use MoviePass?
No, thankfully, no.
What is going on? So the latest, MoviePass stock went to basically nothing, right? Because the company admitted, well, it really isn't a sustainable model. The idea was you pay a flat monthly or weekly rate and you get to as many movies as you want. But that's considerably changed. They've changed their model. They've changed their usage. It has not been a good week for MoviePass. On Wednesday, they were supposed to put a new plan into effect to introduce long-term stability. Actually, that was last week, into the movie subscription service. Instead of $9.95 a month getting subscribers up to one ticket a day, you now get three movies a month. That's a big difference.
A month? I thought it was a week.
I think it's a month, isn't it?
Yeah.
Wow.
This didn't help much.
Oh, yeah.
Companies lost
90% fewer movies a month.
Yeah. $126 million the first half of the year. Lost, spending $73 million a month. Stock went down to, what was it, like a quarter? I don't know what it is right now. A number of people jumped in saying, here's a chance to make some money. They were, unfortunately, not. Here's thousands of investors got creamed.
How did they let it reach that point? Like, you know, they weren't able to pay. weren't able to pay for their, you know, to pay their bills, basically. $78 million, what is it? Did you say a month? It seems like you would see it coming when you don't have money in the bank anymore. I mean, a few months in advance.
The inflection point was when they knocked it down to $10 a month. I mean, originally it was like $35 to $50 a month and appealed to a rather small number of people. And at $10 a month, that's less than one movie ticket in San Francisco. And so they... all of a sudden, they had huge numbers of customers, and every one of them lost the money.
Was that it? They were too successful?
I think so. I mean, that's how their failure scaled up, at least.
Yeah, that's how you lose a lot of money. You only lose a little money if you have a few customers. If you don't, so their latest plan, yeah, it's three movies a month, but you have to pick from the movies on a special list.
Which is not comprehensive.
A daily short list of movies that will be available to subscribers in any given day.
Many of them movies you don't want to see.
I think I'm looking at the list. A lot of them, maybe all of them.
So we have a similar system in France. Yeah. We have a similar system in France, but it's per company or per chain. And you pay $20 a month and you can go see any movie you want anytime you want.
Yeah, they're copying
the
MoviePass.
And the chains have been doing
yeah,
that
but
here
it's
too.
Per company, right? Right. So you have a similar thing in the US as well. The problem MoviePass has is that it's any movie, anywhere, any theater you want, right? That's what makes it impractical, I guess.
Here are the movies you could see tonight on MoviePass. Crazy Rich Asians. That's supposed to be pretty good, kind of a rom-com. Black Klansman. The Miseducation of Cameron Post. We the Animals. Skate Kitchen, which looks like people skating on a banana. Juliet Naked and Summer of 84. None of them have I, except for Crazy Rich Asians, have I heard of. So, well, I don't. You know, I don't. I never understood MoviePass. I think the people who had MoviePass in the first year are very happy, but it seems like there's not much left. So there. So
Black Klansman is Spike Lee. So that's.
I'd go see that then. All right, that sounds good. Okay. I'm not. You're the movie guy. You should know what all these things are. They had surge pricing for a while.
They were going to raise the price to $15, but then they backed down.
What's fascinating to me is that, you know, in Silicon Valley and tech, there are so many examples of these like loss leaders, right? You know, businesses that cost more to operate and to run on a daily basis than they cost more than they're able to actually like make. So, Amazon was famously an example of this, and there are, you know, probably dozens of other that we could rattle off. In this case, people just aren't cool with it. The investors don't want to really participate. It sounds like this company's floundering, and it seems like, you know, the idea of subscription-based movies is just not something that's going to last. You know, ultimately, it seems like the trend that I see happening is that people are going to be, you know, eventually this is going to go direct to consumer, directly to your set-top box at home. I think that that movie theaters, it's getting harder to convince people to spend money on going to the movies, and because they can watch a lot of these things from the comfort of their own home and do so at any time they want. And so I just feel like, yeah, it's just been interesting to watch MoviePass sort of, you know, try to find its way through this like dark room, because in theory it sounds great. You know, you pay a one-time fee, you can go see many movies a month, and it's probably a lot like a gym membership. You know, most people won't go to see a lot of movies.
That was the model, end up, obviously. Yeah,
that's what it seemed like. You know, but what we're learning, or what I'm learning, is that my math was somehow wrong about this. That in fact they're actually losing a ton of money, and it's starting to sound like this is unsustainable. And maybe this model just isn't right for movie fans. You know, for the entertainment industry.
How many movies? I mean, it's like one of those all you can eat restaurants. They just underestimated how much people could eat.
I think there's something weird with the financials there, because in France, the system has been in place for, I think, 15, 20 years now.
Really?
But
it's just one chain, not at a time, right? Or
there are two major chains that each have their own movie pass, essentially, and they're independent. So you can't go to the other chain's theaters.
Yeah, so MoviePass worked anywhere, and they actually had to pay the theater the full ticket price.
In almost all cases.
Right.
So if the theater's doing it, they don't have to pay anybody. They're giving you a deal.
Originally, MoviePass had a vision that movie theaters would love them and cut them a deal.
Movie theaters did not love them.
Which a few small chains do cut MoviePass a deal.
Okay.
But the big ones don't want them inserting themselves in the middle.
AMC hated them.
Yes.
And then released its own plan.
AMC has one.
The big ones can do them.
Which is not bad.
Right.
Yeah, they can do it themselves.
You said in France it's the equivalent of $15 a month, Patrick?
20 euros.
20 euros.
So a little bit more. It's probably 25. But the thing is, if you have that, then you kind of go to the movies, quote unquote, for free. So you're more likely to go to the movies. One thing should be added, though. in France and in Paris especially, it's much easier to go to the movies. You walk out the door and you probably have a theater, you know, 5-10 minutes away by foot. Paris is basically the city with the highest number of movie theaters per capita in the world. We really love our movies. So that might play into this, into it as well. But the fact that you have a subscription to it makes you go more because it's easier. So it's a way of sustaining maybe the industry. And there are a whole lot of other things that happen in the movie industry in France. But for people who are, for an industry where people are getting disinterested in going to a theater, that's a way of keeping them going to the theaters, I think.
This is actually a French invention, the movie pass. You've had this for 15 years.
Yeah.
MoviePass also had this vision that the data they were collecting about movies people like to go to would be very valuable. And if you went to a lot of Marvel movies, someone would be willing to get that data to sell you Marvel DVDs or T-shirts or whatever. And as far as I know, that has yet to pan out.
There was, for a while, they were talking about investing in their own movies. They were talking about selling marketing information to movie companies, doing special promotions that would help box office sales.
Like even out the demand for movies.
Yeah, but none of that happened.
Almost none of it.
It's interesting. I did not realize it started in France, though.
Yeah, it wasn't easy at first because the other one chain started it and the other one had a huge lawsuit claiming it was illegal, and they lost it. So, of course, they did it as well when they lost in order to compete.
Now, Michael, have you looked at any of the competition like Cinemia?
No, I have not. I've never heard of that one.
Yeah, this one actually came out of Europe 4 years ago. $4.99 a month, you can get one ticket a month. $6.99, two tickets. $10, two tickets per month. But that includes something MoviePass never included, which is 3D, 4D, and IMAX movies. $15 a month, three tickets a month. So it's a little more expensive than MoviePass. But
yeah, I don't see how this can work in the long run, because like what I've kind of noticed is that movie theaters are getting much more, they're focusing on like being a luxury experience. You know, they're getting big recliners, and now you can eat dinner at a lot of theaters. And at a few of them you can drink alcoholic beverages, or you know, there's one in my hometown that has a Starbucks in the theater. And so it's becoming, you know, the tickets are way more expensive. They're like $20 to $30 a ticket, and it's almost like a restaurant experience. You know, I'm watching this awesome movie, I'm watching Mission Impossible while I eat chicken wings and drink beer, and that's awesome. But I'm paying.
Welcome to America.
I'm paying the price to do that. I'm paying like $30, and so it doesn't make sense to me how a company could charge only $10 and expect you to go to unlimited movies, or let's say even three movies a month. The math just like doesn't make sense to me unless they're able to, I guess, recoup that through some of the data stuff. You know, that was actually something I didn't know, but I guess it makes complete sense that they would try to, you know, gather more information about their customers and then sell that to you know, different data analysts. But without that extra component of the business, I just don't see how they can sustain themselves over the long haul.
It's pretty clear the only people that can really sensibly do this are big movie chains, because they don't have to pay themselves. AMC's solution, which is called Stubbs A-List, is $20 a month. And you can, but you have to go to an AMC theater, which is fine if you live near an AMC theater. I don't know. Is that unlimited? I guess it is.
The Cinemark one basically boils down to movies for $9 and a discount on popcorn. That's not bad. Every time we go to the movies, we save a few bucks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Movie Club. You buy a movie ticket a month for a discount of $8.99, and you get 20% off popcorn or other concessions. I always thought that the way that, I don't know about this, maybe you guys do, that the way it worked was that the ticket sales went to the movie company and the concession sales went to the theater. Is that correct still, or is that
new movies on the first week? Most of the money goes to the theater, to the movie company.
That's why big opening weekend's a big deal.
And the longer the movie runs, the more the theater gets to keep.
Got it. That makes sense. I think if it's gonna work, it's gonna be Cinemark, it's gonna be AMC, it's gonna be the theaters doing it, as it is in France. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So here's a six. Go ahead. Sorry, Michael.
Well, I was just going to ask, you know, do you think that this is just kind of prolonging the death of the movie theater? I like to think that at some point, at least, one of the big movie production companies has to try releasing something directly to the internet. So
they've been doing some of that. Remember, Sony had a box you could buy, very expensive, that you'd get first run movies, and they would satellite them to you, or somehow get them into that box, but it was only Sony first run movies.
Right. Well, and they did try it with The Interview, which I know there was it was kind of a special circumstance around that particular film because there was the big hack. But again, Sony did try at least to make this movie available to everyone at home. I just feel like that's the way that people want to watch movies now. It's, you know, look at the Academy Awards, for example, or any of these entertainment award shows. You know, more streamers like Netflix are winning awards for their feature films. And I think that if that's the case, there's going to slowly be less of a difference between going to the theater and seeing Mission Impossible 3 versus staying at home and watching another action movie on Netflix. And I just feel like that's the way things are heading.
I think there will always be movie theaters, and the reason is very simple. It's because the movie companies can sell you the movie multiple times, right? If you go to the movies and then buy it on Blu-ray and then watch it on Netflix, they've sold it to you three times instead of once or twice. Of course, it's different if they sell it to you for 30 or 40 bucks at home when it comes out in the theater. But I think the different experiences, people do want different experiences, and maybe there are going to be less movie theaters, but I don't think they're ever going to go away, and it's still going to remain a big part of the business for a long time. It's just it's as long as it makes money. And what we've seen, for all the talk of we just want to stay at home and we want to binge Netflix, you know, in the past few years, we've seen the biggest blockbusters we've ever seen, box offices. So it's
right.
But
is that because they're charging
away
more for tickets, or is that because more people are going to see these movies? I think a lot of
people are still going. I don't know, but I mean, you know, Marvel is doing okay, and they're not the only ones.
It's those movies that are doing the best, though, right? I mean, the big movies, the event movies, the movies you want to see in a theater with a lot of friends, or the movies that have great special effects or sound. So Sean Parker, there's a name you might remember, had a company called Screening Room. A couple of years ago, they announced it. The movie companies were fighting it. Last year, I saw a story that it's still coming, and he had partners including Steven Spielberg, Ron Howard, big filmmakers, Paramount, 20th Century Fox, J.J. Abrams, Peter Jackson. Nothing happened. Now, this is an article from Odyssey, the best way to watch newly released movies in your house. I don't know how you would get this. It's still coming soon. You pay $50 for a 48-hour rental, but it's the same day and date that the movie comes to the theaters. And, of course, you have to buy the setup, which is $150 itself. Would you do that? $50 a movie to be able to not go to the theater?
Yeah, some people would.
If you had like this 100-inch screen we've got here in the studio, maybe, and a giant surround sound system. I like going to the movies, but I don't go every week for sure. I don't know.
I like getting out of the house, personally.
What do young people do? Do they still go to movies?
I like being around other people.
We do, but, you know, a lot of my friends, so I'm 30 now, and a lot of my friends have recently started having kids.
That's what screws it for you.
There is a big change in priorities, there should be, when that starts to happen for people. So I think, you know, when you're young and either single or with someone, and you don't have the constraint of being a parent, then absolutely, you know, movie night is a great date. But when you add the element of kids, I think it becomes way, way harder to justify going to a lot of movies. And then often what I've kind of noticed that the types of movies that they actually go out to are no longer, you know, summer blockbusters. They're often like, you know, just these big franchises, I guess, like, you know, Infinity Wars, Avengers, or I don't know what.
It's ironic because we thought television would kill movies back in the 60s and 70s. It didn't. But the internet has done a pretty good bit of damage to the movie industry. I guess
I don't think so. I don't think so. It hasn't. People, well, as we were saying, the box office is very successful still. Maybe it's not exactly all the same movies that are making a lot of money. And also the in-house day and date of release, you know, $50 movie ticket or movie streaming, whatever it ends up being. As you were saying, it's not selling the movie to people who would go see it in the theaters. It's selling it to the parents with young kids who can't go to the theater, right? It's selling it to people who wouldn't be going otherwise, mostly. I mean, there's going to be some intersection there.
Here's an interesting graph. It really depends who you talk to about how movies are doing. The blue line is the number of tickets sold. That is dropping. The red line is the revenue. That is going up because tickets are much more expensive. And in fact, it's gone up and more than made up for the loss in ticket sales. But if I'm in the movie industry, I might be starting to worry. Well, I guess ticket sales are about the same as they were in 95. But if you compare 2002, where ticket sales are 1.5 billion tickets sold compared to the bottom last year, 1.2 billion, that is a drop. So I don't know. I guess it depends who you ask.
You know, it is a drop, but maybe in the same way that the music industry has seen its volume drop. If you look at the volume, you know, the revenue of the music industry, it's dropped, but I can't remember exactly, but it's like to what it was 20 years ago or something like that.
Get this. The average ticket price in 1995, Batman Forever came out, $4.35.
I always wonder which people are paying these prices.
I don't know. They say the average price this year is $9. It's a lot more than that in Petaluma. I think it's more like $12.
Yeah, San Francisco.
And movie budgets are also a lot higher. So I don't think you could make the movies you're making now with the $4.
But that's what's driving continued, I think, ticket sales is the blockbusters, I would guess. Mm-hmm. The Star Wars, the Marvels, things like that. I don't know how we got into movies. I like talking about movies. Oh, MoviePass, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I feel like it's a key part of technology, right? You know, a lot of us have reviewed tech for a long time, and you know, I feel like the foundation for tech reviewing was building a home entertainment system. You know, a lot
that's
of people
true.
this is
in
like
the
part
old
of
days.
The American dream.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and like, yeah, this is what most Americans want. You know, they imagine a gigantic flat screen. They imagine having surround sound to augment that experience. And then you start to add little boxes to it. You know, it could be a Fire TV, it could be an Apple TV, it could be an Xbox One, PlayStation 4, but you know, all of these things inevitably create, you know, what used to be called a man cave, which is not. I feel like that's not really a term that's thrown around much because it's a sexist term. But this was part of the American dream, at least in my opinion.
No, that's an interesting point of view. Yeah. That it was all about getting that man cave going. That technology.
Yeah, you wanted a house and a white picket fence, and within the house, you wanted your command center, if you want to call it that.
Let's see. This was the success story of the week. August 13th, what is that, 4 days ago, 5 days ago, the AP unveiled a study that they had commissioned from researchers at Princeton that showed even after you turn location history off on an Android device, Google was still tracking you. An app like Google Maps would, every time you open it, not only save your location but send it off to the Google servers. After the study came out, Google responded by clarifying its policy. And I think that's really what was wrong here, was not so much that Google was doing that. I mean, when you open a Maps app, of course Google's going to have to say, well, where are you? And then send that back to the servers so you can download that data. It just needed to be more clear to users that that was what's going on. If you want to use a map, even with location tracking turned off, we need to know where you are. Now Google has modified its help page for the location history setting, saying, quote, this setting, location history, does not affect other location services on your device. Some location data may be saved as part of your activity on other services like search and maps. Tempest in a teapot, or did the AP catch Google with its hand in the cookie jar? Your thoughts?
The wording was definitely confusing. I think location history, if I understand correctly, is basically if you personally want to keep a log of where you've been because it can be interesting, that's what that's for, in the same way that like the web search history is something you can go back to.
Yeah.
But they certainly did not make that clear, and I could totally understand why people would think it was more sweeping.
If you turned off location, your maps wouldn't work, but Google wouldn't know where you are. So,
well, it's semantics. It's location history, right? The name of the setting. It's not location or, you know, GPS. It's location history. So the expectation from this would be you don't store my location history in the way that Harry was defining it. And there was some semantics that were not great there, but location, I guess my point is location history is not just location. It's location history. Doesn't mean you're disabling location period.
Right. Yeah, it's in Google's interest to be as clear as possible about all this. In fact,
absolutely.
The AP pointed out, I've forgotten about this. Remember Google Buzz? Google got in a lot of trouble. An early social network attempt by Google leaked people's email and other information. Google was fined, and the FTC, and actually made a 20-year agreement with the FTC. This is back in 2011, in which they said the consent decree said Google will not misrepresent to consumers how they can protect their privacy. They actually have a legal burden to show consumers what they can do to protect their privacy. So that seems, you know, I think that's pretty cool. I think Google not only has an obligation to do it just morally, but now they also have a legal obligation. Be clear. That's all. Just tell us what you're doing. FTC is not saying whether they're investigating Google over this. Go ahead.
Well, these tech companies have gotten really good at this type of language. You know, it's always like one or two words.
Yeah,
exactly. I think it's been referred to as something called dark patterns in user interfaces or just in language. So, you know, I think I'm noticing this a little bit more, especially following the GDPR, because although a lot of these companies are compliant with this new data privacy law that's been established by the EU, a lot of them are still, you know, using what I would consider misleading language. I think that just through the way that they design these user interfaces, they sort of lead customers to believe that sharing information at all times is the best. You know, ultimately that's going to lead to the best experience, which I think is partially true. But there are a lot of things that are either omitted or just not described plainly by Facebook, by Google, by Twitter, by a lot of these data mining companies, that I think, you know, I think the more attention deserves to be, we should be having more discussions like this about the way that the language is built on a lot of these sites, because, you know, sure, maybe this was a mistake, but also you have some of the smartest minds in the world. You have a team of thousands and thousands of engineers working on this. How could you not possibly get this right? I think that we're giving companies like Google in this case a lot of leeway and a lot of room to fail. I mean, I think maybe this isn't the most egregious thing that they've done all year, and there are other big issues that the company is dealing with, but it does bug me that that something as plain as location history, in my opinion, it's pretty obvious. You should not be logging customers' locations if they opt out of that, you know, through the location history setting. What Google said was that that multiple settings exist throughout their various products, and so the language was a little bit off, and it sort of misdescribed what was happening in a different program rather than Google Maps. And I think that, you know, these companies have become really good at obfuscating the truth, which is that they're trying to follow you every second of the day, your location, your interests, your general disposition. They're trying to profile you in as many ways as possible so that they can help advertisers target you.
Do you think they're afraid of telling the truth, that like it'll scare people and then they won't use the services?
100%. Yes, I do. I think
they're just
that,
not telling the truth because they don't want to scare us.
Yeah, I think if people understood how powerful these artificial intelligence engines were, that then they'd be frightened. I think that people would be disturbed by how much information is available through various data brokers. You know, it's not just tech companies. Obviously, there are there are databases of credit card information, and hedge fund managers can go buy that information, or maybe it's a magazine. So you subscribe to Wired and to GQ, and so they know that you're a male that's into fashion and tech. And there's ways of getting those bits of information. The issue is that companies like Facebook and Google specialize in gathering all of that information from all of those various data brokers and then packaging it and reselling it to new advertisers. And I think if people understood how powerful these machines are and how dramatic the effects can be on your disposition, on your feelings day to day, just based on what you see, I think people would be disturbed, to say the least.
So I think they already are.
It's a grim view.
I think they are. We've been talking about this for a couple of years now. You know, the tech companies are not the darlings that they were a few years ago. And you mentioned GDPR. And I have to say, even myself, I don't know if you get as many of those notices for GDPR in the US that we do in Europe. I'm guessing less. But I use private browsing on Safari on my iPhone and iPad, and I have, Chrome on my PC. So obviously I'm completely tracked on everything on the PC. But on the private browsing, I have gotten to the point after, 2 months now of GDPR being in effect, where I don't even look at the banners anymore. It's constant. The banners have to be like a third of the size of the web page, at least. On the phone, it usually takes half of it. I don't look at them anymore. I just click OK, accept, 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 accept. So I don't really know what the solution is, because I think arguably this is the most compelling and complete solution you can offer. And yes, there are dark patterns, but I don't even want to look at them because it's on every site every time I visit. So I just click accept. I'm just realizing what's happening now after just a couple of months. I don't think that's working either. So I don't know what the solution is.
No, it's in fact the opposite, isn't it? You become inured.
Yeah.
To
now
it.
I've given consent.
We see that we get the Chrome and the cookie announcements now.
Mm.
It's really annoying. Every web page. I use cookies. Of course you use cookies. Is that okay? Yes.
Yeah.
And at this point, you just accept, accept, accept. It has not accomplished anything.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
I don't think so.
I mean, it has built the framework to build upon. It's,
Yeah, and I think you're right, because the companies now are being much more careful about what they do.
Yeah, and like any law, I think that laws are rarely perfect when they first roll out. They're often refined over time, right? So it's a good start, in my opinion.
I think at the very least, they have to be forthcoming and offer you possibilities. I think the one part that is a little bit, that becomes annoying, is the fact that you have to accept everything all the time. But the fact that they have been put on notice and that they have to let you change some of the settings, or, it doesn't need to be a giant banner all the time.
Right.
Maybe they would, a better approach would have been, you have to have some kind of API to let your browser extension decide what type of tracking you're okay with, and that propagates without you having to click and select and do all of that. And I don't think it would have been much more complicated than what the webmasters had, the web developers had to do already for GDPR. So maybe there's an iteration on this
Here's my conspiracy theory, paranoid. Does GDPR say you have to put up the cookie announcement? You have to get the consent this way, or
yes.
It does. Because I'm thinking the companies are doing this on purpose. They're making it as kind of repetitive as possible so that you just get used to it and say, okay, fine.
And I don't yeah. I know they're using cookies already. What I care about is what they're using those cookies for, which that message never really explains.
So I feel like maybe companies
are. It does.
I remember when I was a kid, I think I've told this story before. I went to a power plant. We had a tour of a power plant. And everywhere in the power plant, they had signs, conserve, you know, be green. This was in the 60s. Be green, conserve. So, and my teacher said, they just put those up everywhere. They don't really have any intent. They just want to inure you to the whole idea so that you just go, yeah, you're conserving. And forget about it. It's one way people, it is an interesting technique. You just say it over and over again till it becomes nothing. Meaningless. Maybe that's what they're doing.
I feel like these companies are using just these huge walls of text to, you know, it's like to intimidate people. It's like your terms of service. You know, when's the last time you read a terms of service agreement before you actually agreed to it?
Oh, nobody reads
It's probably
those,
been,
right?
Yeah. Yeah, no one reads those. And that's what this GDPR, what these GDPR notifications are turning into. It's another wall of text that we're, you know, that we're asked to scroll through for legal purposes. But, you know, but no one is taking the time to read this, and the companies have very little incentive to actually explain this information to people. In my opinion, you know, what I think that there should be more of is more insight into the back end. We should have at least some exposure to what's going on the back end.
If
they're going to
collect with it, that's what Harry said.
Yeah, if you're collecting all that information about all these individuals, including myself, I'd like to see what that profile looks like and how it's being
used.
And
that gets us back to where we were, because that's what we're saying to Google. You just be clear. Just tell us what you're doing. It's okay. And then I think we concluded they're not doing that because they know that we'll go, God.
We know
that's
what
terrible.
They're doing.
But we don't.
We don't know.
You and I know,
details.
Patrick. We know. The panel knows. The listeners know. But the average Joe doesn't have any idea, really.
I think most people understand the general idea of it. They collect your information and then use it to target you for ads. Right. And we've had enough examples now that we know exactly how that can work. And just like you don't ask every person in the world to have an intimate understanding of the medical procedures that are happening in a hospital every day, you can't ask every person on the planet to have an intimate understanding of how the profile is built on an ad tech company to sell you ads. It's with the GDPR, I've looked into the options of a few of them. Some of them are very complicated, and you can feel that they make you go through three levels of accepting and of details to confuse you. Some of them are quite simple. Right. Some of them you really understand, you know, these are the cookies that we need in order for the site to function. These are the ones we use for ad tracking. This is, you know, you have a few categories. Some of them are pretty clear, but even those, I would bet you no one bothers to go look into them. There is, I think, a fantasy on the tech knowing population that is, if only people knew, if only people had the option, then they would take matters into their own hands and refuse. And like, we're seeing more and every time I've seen one of those things, you know, the cookies initially a few years ago and now the GDPR, it's well-intentioned. I think the implementation could be improved. But after the initial burst of either outrage of satisfaction, people just stop caring. And I'm not saying it shouldn't be there. I think GDPR especially is good because it allows people like us to make sure we keep an eye on what's happening. So there's more transparency happening, and that's good. But the idea that the general public is going to take matters into their own hands is a fantasy, just like you're not going to go and repair your car yourself and know exactly how it works. You bring it to the shop and they do it for you. So
by the way, somebody in the chat room is pointing out, and I know this, that the cookie thing is actually predates GDPR. I don't know what happened with GDPR that every site now does it. It may be that GDPR has, I don't know, has stepped up the enforcement or something. But now it's much more prevalent than it used to be. It used to be you'd only
We've had cookies disclaimers for
forever.
I don't know.
The All Things D site, I remember, used to do it. And that might have been the first time I saw it.
Yeah. And yet it stepped up. I see it now every site.
But the GDPR notices are lit. I think I'm not 100% sure, but I think it states
get those in the
it has
US.
To be at least a third of the size of your website.
That's
like you can't miss it.
Yeah.
And that's specifically because with the cookies, they would put a tiny little bar at the bottom that you wouldn't really see or care about.
So it's more that. Obvious. I also think more American companies are doing it because there's now penalties for companies that do business in Europe, no matter where they are headquartered. And so that's why we're seeing this a lot more than we did before. Let's take a break. Come back with more. Patrick Beja, not Patrick. It's only what time? 3 a.m. now?
It's getting to 3 a.m.
okay.
now. Yeah,
it's only 3.
Wow.
In the
but it's
morning.
Good. You got fired up with GDPR.
Good.
Now I'm good to go for another hour.
Well, and I've learned something that the French invented MoviePass.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. That
well,
was...
the business viable version of MoviePass.
Yeah, the one that works. You've had it for 15 years. From Mashable, Michael Nunez is also here. He's deputy tech editor at Mashable. Great to have you, Michael. He's in
Thanks
New York.
Thanks for having me.
So it's not that late. Not that
no,
late.
No, not too bad at all.
Game of Thrones isn't on or anything, so you could stay late.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Harry McCracken, the technologizer. Great
it's
to have
mid-afternoon
you.
Here.
It's mid-afternoon. It's early. There's plenty of time left. Our show today brought to you by Rocket Mortgage. If you're home hunting, you may not feel like there's plenty of time left. You watch those interest rates kind of ticking up and thinking, if it goes up another quarter point, that's going to be thousands of dollars more this home's going to cost us. That might put some pressure on you. That's why the folks at Quicken Loans have decided, they're very customer focused. They decided there's a better way to get you a home loan, a way that takes the anxiety out of it. They call it their power buying process. We've talked about Rocket Mortgage before, how it makes it easy to get a loan. You could do it all online, even on your phone. You could do it from an open house. There's several stages that are involved in this new power buying process. The first stage we've talked about before, you go to rocketmortgage.com/twit2. rocketmortgage.com/twit2. And you answer a few questions. They have relationships with all the financial institutions. So they just say, is it all right if we go get that information? You say yes. You don't have to go to the attic and pull out pay stubs or anything like that. They get everything they need. They say, yeah, good. Pick a loan. You're ready. We're ready. Within 24 hours, they then give you the next step, which is verified approval. Now, at this point, you've got a letter. You could show the realtor. You could say, look, I'm good for it. I'm good for it. You basically have the strength of a cash buyer. That is awesome. So that takes a lot of the pressure out, too. When you're making an offer on a house, you know you've got the loan. But here's the best part. Once you qualify, you've got the all-new Rate Shield approval. They lock up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. You have 3 months, and the interest rates can't go up. You have up to 3 months to shop. No pressure. Don't worry about the interest rates going up. If they go down, they'll go down. But they're not going to go up. It's exactly what you'd expect from America's best mortgage lender. Number one in customer satisfaction 8 years in a row, according to J.D. Power. Number one in volume, too. They're America's largest and best. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/twit2. Rate Shield approval is only valid in certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, and MLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030. It's rocketmortgage.com/twit2. rocketmortgage.com/twit2. We thank them so much for making Twit possible. Here's a little revelation. This actually happened months ago, but is now become public thanks to Reuters. Federal government, the Department of Justice, is asking Facebook for help wiretapping Facebook Messenger. They want to hear a suspect's voice conversations in a criminal probe. This is according to Reuters, who say three people briefed on the case said this. It was an unreported case in federal court. It's under seal. No filings are publicly available. Facebook, according to the source, is contesting the DOJ's demand. This is coming up in Fresno, California, as part of an investigation of the MS-13 gang. Facebook's fighting. I don't know how long they can fight, though. Ultimately, isn't this just out of their hands? The court will rule and Facebook will have to do it. This is similar to the FBI asking Apple to decrypt the iPhone.
Isn't Messenger encrypted, though?
I think it can be.
Messenger and WhatsApp can be encrypted, but I don't think it's that kind of encryption that Facebook can't see the information. I'm not sure.
So it's not end-to-end.
I don't believe it's end-to-end.
I think it is end-to-end for WhatsApp, but Messenger, I'm not sure.
It is end-to-end for WhatsApp. And Messenger, they want the voice calls, so I don't know what the privacy is. The fact that Facebook's fighting, it sounds like they can do it.
Yeah.
They just don't want to do it. Mm. Yeah. Anything to say about this? How do we feel about it? I have such mixed feelings because on the one hand, you want to help police catch bad guys.
If it's not end-to-end encrypted and Facebook can give it and they're going through the proper channels, it seems like there's not a lot to be upset about. Is there?
Yeah, I guess you're right. It's not encrypted. It's something else completely if Facebook didn't have access to it and they're being asked to provide a backdoor that doesn't exist.
Right. Or if the government was saying you have to put in a backdoor for the future. That's a very different conversation.
Right. All right. Well, that was easy. Thank you, Pat.
You're welcome.
Got that all straightened out.
Be reasonable today.
Here's an article from New York Magazine. SEO is back. Thank God. Now, a few people might say, wait a minute, what's to think about that, SEO, search engine optimization? And the reason is this report from The Australian that Campbell Brown was in Sydney last week talking to publishers, actually specifically the Murdoch-owned Australian, saying, we're not interested in talking to you about your traffic and referrals anymore. That is the old world. There's no going back. She said, Zuckerberg's giving me a lot of leeway and concessions, but it looks like your business is dying. And you
can't. For a hospice.
It's headed for the hospice, and you can't count on us to send you traffic anymore.
Although I believe Facebook said she did not say that, at least in those words.
On the other hand, I've heard it from other sources that Campbell Brown, who was, of course, a journalist for many years and now works with Facebook to liaise with the journalists, is being fairly blunt that, look, we're not here to help you to drive traffic to you. You know, you've got to solve your own business problems yourself. Don't expect us to come in and save you. I don't think that that's so bad. In fact, this article in New York Magazine says, great, that old world, the world where, you know, magazines would put headlines in designed to drive social media traffic or you won't believe what happened next kind of headlines. New York Magazine writes, that old world absolutely sucked and it made the internet ecosystem a discernibly worse place. Sometime around 2012, the ecology of digital publishing underwent an epical shift. Yeah, I'd like you to talk about this, Harry, because you've seen this happen directly. Facebook overtook Google as the top traffic source on the web. So in the past, you know, you'd be doing SEO to get higher Google ranking. But SEO isn't all that bad. It's, according to this article, sort of a guessing game, a digital Jeopardy in which the person creating web content tries to think of the query that will get users to their web content. So that's why an article might be headlined, what time is the Super Bowl, as opposed to the Super Bowl is coming up soon. But you could argue, well, yeah, you're trying to be more helpful. Instead, when Facebook got involved, the key to a good piece of Facebook-optimized content was that it was emotionally intelligent, often in an exaggerated manner. It wasn't just 21 pictures that will make you feel good. It was 21 pictures that will restore your faith in humanity.
I did a story on all the things that would restore your faith in humanity once.
Did you really?
Yes. For a while, that headline was just everywhere.
Everywhere.
And there was always just like a very slapped together list of fun photos.
The author of this article, in fact, I want to give the author credit, Brian Feldman, says, for instance, when a writer pads their article for the trailer of the newest Marvel movie for SEO, they'll pad it with searchable keywords like the cast and crew and the opening date. They're optimizing for SEO, but that provides genuinely useful information.
It's a good piece. I mean, I think it is complicated. I think the worst Facebooky headlines stopped working very well a while ago, and you don't see anywhere near as many of them as you used to. I always associate them with the site Upworthy, which collapsed in the last week or two.
But, oh, did it really?
Yeah. But back in 2012, it was going gangbusters in those headlines.
It was basically driven a way to become, viral content. It started, ironically, by Eli Pariser, the guy who wrote the book about the filter bubble.
Right.
I said, well, since I understand this, let's create a company about it.
I also feel like ultimately you should write headlines that will accurately describe your way, your stories in an appealing way, which is of interest to human beings. And if you do that and you're being accurate, that's an entirely moral thing to do. And it has the side benefit of also helping you on Facebook and Twitter and Google.
Right.
It's being deceptive or cheesy. That's a bad thing. And that has not worked well for a while now. BuzzFeed used to have headlines like that, but BuzzFeed overall, the quality of their content and the quality of their headlines has both improved recently.
I agree,
As it turned out, the cheesy stuff was kind of a dead end.
Yeah. Feldman writes, it was difficult for any publisher to resist, given how much traffic the Facebook system brought to others. Now, by Facebook's own account, the valve to the fire hose has been closed. Great. Use it to build brand or awareness or whatever, but otherwise it's time to recalibrate and leave the reliance on Facebook as a traffic source behind. I think that's well written.
I mean, readers learned.
And good news.
Readers got really jaded once they noticed that there were all these headlines on Facebook that were entirely deceptive and which led to junk.
Right.
And when
they
that
didn't stop them from sharing it.
Well, I think over time it did a little bit.
Did it?
It certainly at first it was helpful.
I think I remember for a long time the studies were that people don't read the articles they share. Right. They just look at the headline. If it sounds interesting, they pass it along.
It is amazing. I mean, to this day, sometimes I will post something on Twitter and people will share it within 3 seconds, clearly not having read my article.
Yeah. You didn't have time.
I mean, hopefully that's a sign that they're sort of vaguely aware of Fast Company or of me and have some faith.
Maybe that's it.
That the headline is intriguing, it's a good story.
It's definitely it. Jan Koum, who was one of the founders of WhatsApp and kind of gotten a little tiff with Facebook over advertising and WhatsApp, Facebook wants to do it. Jan Koum does not. There's also some issue about, we were talking about encryption in WhatsApp and whether Facebook, you know, maybe would do end-to-end or not. He quit in April, or said he was quitting in April. But according to this article in the Wall Street Journal, he continues to show up once a month. Now, remember, Facebook bought WhatsApp for money and stock which skyrocketed to over $22 billion for an app. I think that's still the record price paid for an app. Koum has been there for 3.5 years. As usual in this kind of acquisition, the stock doesn't vest all at once. You don't get to use it all at once. It's kind of spread out over a period of time. So apparently, Facebook spokeswoman declined to comment on Mr. Coombs' schedule, but said he remains employed at the company working on various products and helping transition WhatsApp leadership. Here's why, if you're Coombs, you want to show up. He still has about $450 million worth of Facebook stock that he hasn't cashed in. He's set to collect it right about now, 2.5 million shares. It's contingent on him being employed at Facebook. So he's still showing up. They call it rest and vest.
Yeah, I'd like that schedule if possible.
These guys live in another world entirely, don't they? Wow.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I don't blame him. You don't want to turn down that much money. Koum is worth about $9 billion. WhatsApp co-founder Brian Acton, who quit a while ago, worth $3 billion. Neither one of them, though, wanted advertising and WhatsApp. I don't think there is advertising yet, but I think it's just probably a matter of time.
They have to make money.
You got to make money
with it at some point.
99 cents a year is not, you know, big bucks.
Which they don't charge.
I thought they already made money through that.
No, they don't do it anymore.
No, they scrapped it, I think.
Yeah, it's free now.
Oh, is that so?
Mr. Acton resigned in September, leaving behind, get this, $900 million in unvested shares. That's a principled stand. Walk away from $900 million.
Wow.
Let's see. What else? What else is going on in the world of tech?
And Acton is the bigger critic of the two, right? He's the one that's been kind of outspoken.
He's been the one that says get off Facebook. He says get off Facebook.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I kind of love that.
Are you still on Facebook though? You work at Mashable. You have to be.
I am. Yeah. Ultimately, Facebook is something that I love and that I'm fascinated by. I'm critical of it because I enjoy it so much.
Yeah, I'm deactivated. which is why I'm here today instead of at the Tech TV reunion picnic, which is going on right now in Golden Gate Park, but I didn't know anything about because I'm not on Facebook.
These days you're not missing out on that much. I feel like what I've kind of noticed is there's been an interesting migration to Instagram. I feel like, at least anecdotally, you know, the people that I know are moving from Facebook to Instagram, and then like the younger people that I know are just skipping Facebook altogether.
Good.
And going straight to Instagram.
Instagram doesn't seem to be nearly as negatively impactful on your life. How else would I know about what Patrick's baby looks like?
Right. Well, Instagram is really obviously focused on pictures, but they even don't show you the comments of people who you're not following unless you specifically tap on the, you know, show more comments thing. Right. It's not about, and you can't really share links or anything like that. It's the kind of the best parts of Facebook. You just see, you keep in touch with family and friends through pictures, which is the quote unquote good part of Facebook. So it makes sense.
Yeah, I like pictures. Let's see. Ajit Pai tells the Senate why he lied to them.
Oh, God.
He said, I didn't want to, but I had to. I had to. I was told I couldn't tell you. So this goes back to the net neutrality regulations and FCC opening up their comment area for comments, and John Oliver saying, again, for the second time, everybody should go there and tell them preserve net neutrality. So many people did. The site went down. Could have just been traffic, too much traffic. It went down the first time, too, right? Instead, the FCC said we were hit by a cyber attack. It was a DDoS. And we can't accept any more comments. That's it. We're done. Pai went before a congressional committee for the first time this week since a internal investigation found that the agency misled the public by claiming it was a cyber attack. Ajit Pai said, I couldn't tell you. I was told I was bound by a request for confidentiality by the Department of the Inspector General. The FCC, Pai said, quote, wanted to get this information to you sooner, but I made the judgment we had to adhere to the request, even though I knew we would be falsely attacked for having done something inappropriate.
What?
I know, it's a little bit head spinning.
How is this, you know, so first of all, they claimed it was a DDoS, and it wasn't, they weren't claiming, it was the CTO who was saying it was a DDoS, but he knew it wasn't a DDoS, but they said it was a DDoS anyway. And then there was an investigation that said, okay, it's not a DDoS, but you can't say it's not a DDoS. And then in the end, they said they didn't worry about any of the comments. This makes no sense at all. None of it makes sense. And we were talking about, you know, the dark patterns and the way the companies confuse you in the...
Yeah.
That's what he's doing, right? Am I crazy? That's what he's doing.
I wouldn't care so much if it weren't as kind of important that net neutrality be preserved.
Yeah, exactly. And they have an obligation to... my understanding... I'm from Europe, so I'm not exactly sure my information is accurate, but my understanding is the FCC is supposed to, like... legally take into account the comments that they have on the decision.
That's for sure true. But they
didn't. They didn't.
Because the comments were overwhelmingly in favor of preserving that neutrality.
Right. And whether or not it was automated or not, and like there was something happening that should have legally made them take a minute to try and understand what the comments were, if they're legally
obliged. Now you've gotten to the nut of the matter.
Consideration.
They didn't want to look at the comments. They used this as a pretext for ignoring all comments and doing what they really wanted to do
in
the first place.
Which everyone knew it wasn't a DDoS.
Right. And we all knew that.
Yes. It might have been a lot of traffic, but it... Right. So it's... Anyway.
It's worth saying that this is pretty common in American politics right now, too, which is the strategy is to lie now and then
apologize
find a way
later.
To wriggle out of your. Yeah, it's like, yeah. Well, there is no apologizing.
And
you know, you know, heaven forbid someone admitted.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And they just find a strategy to pull out of that lie, you know, later, long after the lie's been made. So it's just super disappointing when it comes to you know, leaders doing this on important tech issues, because, you know, this is the thing that's going to carry the country forward in a lot of cases. And you know, we should be sort of the guiding light, or, you know, we should be laying the foundation for the rest of the world to follow, you know, when it comes to a lot of these things. But instead, we're just it's I don't know, man. It's really disappointing when I read stuff like this, because I just think that it's hurting people in ways that they probably don't understand.
Yeah, the federal appeals court has stayed an FCC decision pending appeal. The FCC said that they were going to kill tribal subsidies for Lifeline Internet access, a $25 a month Lifeline subsidy. The court said, nope, can't do it. We're going to have to go back to court and fight it. The tribes and the small carriers who provide the Internet to the tribes had sued the FCC, saying there's a substantial risk tribal populations will suffer widespread loss of vital telecommunications services if the stay isn't approved. It was. So a little victory there. Let's take a break, and I've got the bits and pieces, including some amazing inventions in the annals of technology. But first, a word from an amazing invention in the annals of the postal service. You wouldn't think there'd be a new and better way to do stamps, but there is stamps.com. We're not talking a postage meter. We're talking about buying and printing real U.S. postage the minute you need it, using your computer and your printer from stamps.com. In fact, you get all these amazing services of the post office right from your desk any time of the day or night, whenever you need it. You can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail. The mail carrier still comes and picks it up. Actually, it's even better than that, because regulations require that if you have a package greater than a pound, you can't put it in the mailbox. You have to bring it to the post office unless you use stamps.com. Mail carrier will pick it up no matter what size. Stamps.com suggests ways to save money. You can actually get discounts you won't even get at the post office. It fills in all the forms for you for international mailing and certified mail. No equipment to lease, no long-term commitments. You'll even get a digital scale that automatically calculates exact postage. And it looks great. You can print right on the envelope. The return address automatically printed, a corporate logo if you want. It'll take the address of this recipient from your address book, fill it in automatically for you. A lot less typing, a lot faster, a lot more professional looking. Prints out labels for packages. And we have an amazing special offer that includes $55 in free postage, that digital scale I mentioned, and a four-week trial. All you have to do is go to stamps.com. Up in the upper right-hand corner on the website, you'll see a radio microphone. Click that, enter TWIT, and you're going to get an amazing offer. They're giving you $55 in free postage just to try stamps.com. We use it here, and you will love it, too. There's no better way to do everything you would do at the post office right from your desk. Stamps.com. Enter TWIT, and you're going to get an amazing offer. World's smallest transistor switches. This is amazing story. So Intel has had some trouble.
What's the one atom one?
The one atom. Intel's had trouble getting 10 nanometer parts made. They say maybe next year, much to the chagrin of Apple and others who depend on Intel parts. Scientists in, I assume this is Holland, at the Karlsruhe Institute of Technology, have come up with the world's smallest transistor switches. Now, it's one atom, which is about a tenth of a nanometer. So that is 100th times, 1/100th the size of even the chip that Intel can't make. One atom, repositioning that single atom in a gel, works as a transistor. But even more importantly, they've done this before at absolute zero, 273 degrees Celsius below zero. This is at room temperature, which means it consumes very little energy. In fact, a significant factor less. This quantum electronics element enables switching energies smaller than those of conventional silicon technologies by a factor of, get ready, 10,000. 10,000. So imagine, you know, getting 100 times more storage in the same size at a 10,000th of the electricity. This sounds really good. Now, I don't know what the manufacturing situation is, but I think that's an important breakthrough. I just wanted to pass that along.
It does feel like this is a kind of fundamental research kind of thing that, you know, just like we hear about exciting, incredible new battery technology, and we've been hearing about this for, you know, 15 years. Is this actually going to turn into something that we can use in the next 20 years?
Yeah, or? You never know. By the way, Karlsruhe Institute of Technology is in Germany. I apologize. It's in Karlsruhe, Germany, of all places. Or is it Karlsruhe? I'm not sure. They deserve credit. No, you know, it's funny because remember we were all excited about that cross-point technology Intel announced, the 3D chip technology that would increase the density. And so, and it took a few years, but it's Optane. Intel has announced it. It's going to ship it. Or it's shipping it, some of it already.
IBM tends to announce breakthroughs that sound incredible, and I feel like we need to go back and follow up on them. And
see where they're.
See where they lead.
Supercapacitors, we were all excited about that about 5 years ago. Now there's a supercapacitor in the S Pen in the Galaxy Note 9 that allows you to charge it in 40 seconds. So I do think these things get out here. We should probably pay more attention to how long. Who knows? I mean, maybe there's all sorts of issues with single atom transistors, but I just think that's a fascinating story. I had to mention it. There was another invention I wanted to talk about. Maybe it was this, the digital birth control app that is only 93% effective but has now been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. Maybe it's that one.
What?
Huh? Natural Cycles.
I'm sorry,
it's from Sweden. What? It's up your way. It's from Sweden. It's the rhythm method. You've probably heard of this.
Right.
It includes a thermometer and an app, and you take your temperature, and it tells you if you're fertile or not. If it's used perfectly, Natural Cycles says it's 99% effective, but under typical use, 93% effective. And in fact, one hospital in Sweden reported 37 cases of unwanted pregnancies among women using the app. So, but it is approved. According to Natural Cycles, 900,000 people use the mobile app. Let's see, 900,000 with a 7% rate of pregnancy. Ooh, that's a lot of babies.
Well, I guess it's approved doesn't mean that,
it's,
you know,
perfect.
The FDA is saying this is a method of birth control. It's an app that tells you if you use it normally, you're going to have a 93% chance of not having a baby. And it states this pretty clearly.
They're clear. Yeah.
I guess it wouldn't be the place for the FDA to say, no, you can't sell this, or you can't.
Well, they could say, you know, you need to have some disclaimers on here or be more clear about how effective it is. The rhythm method is not new. For a long time, I don't know if it's still the case, it was the only contraception method approved by the Catholic Church. It may still be the case. I bet it is. Let's see. ISPs say they can't expand broadband unless government gives them more money.
Oh.
Enough said. Your sigh was sufficient.
The irony / gull of them doing this a few months after the net neutrality issue, which in part was implemented because the idea was, well, we need to invest more so we can have any kind of government regulation or restriction, because then you're going to kill the internet. And it is, you know, I don't want to say bad things about America on a panel that has three Americans and me alone, but
no, we're right there with you, Patrick. Yeah, we're right there with you.
Speak freely. You're fine.
Martin Marcic. He's an Italian. He was arrested August 8th in San Francisco as he was flying into town. He's accused of hacking Electronic Arts, the video game company. The judge posted bail of $750,000 worth of Bitcoin or any other kind of cryptocurrency. It's the first time we know of in the United States that Bitcoin has been requested for bail. Apparently, cryptocurrency is now accepted in federal court. Just thought you'd like
Why
to know.
Why did they request Bitcoin? Was it because he had Bitcoin and no money? Or
I don't know. I don't know.
I think the IRS stated that Bitcoin is property and not currency. So,
well, you're allowed in this country to post property as bail. You could say, "I want to give you."
Right. So there you go. Okay. Yeah. So that's probably how it worked out. Yeah.
Yeah. Judges can order many kinds of bail, according to this article in the Daily Post. I don't know where the Daily Post is from, but I trust it. And it looks like Steam is going to do another streaming gaming service like Twitch, like Amazon owns Twitch. What was it? It was Caffeine TV, and now Steam, Valve's Steam. Steam TV was briefly live.
There's a Mixer
live.
As well from
Mixer
Microsoft.
From Microsoft, right. Steam was briefly live showing the Dota 2 competition. But it was an accident. Valve said that was just a test feed that accidentally went public. However, those who saw it said it worked pretty well. So get ready. Steam TV is coming. I like it because we're on Twitch. We're on Mixer. We're on YouTube. You know, these services, it doesn't just have to be gaming. They allow us to stream free. I like it. I think it's a good thing. Ironically, we were on Ustream for many years, and now IBM is charging for their streaming. It's not free anymore, so... It's a good thing there's others. Ladies and gentlemen, we have come to the logical conclusion of this show. I want to thank you for being here. Thanks to Patrick Beja, who stayed up late. Stayed up way
Always
late.
A pleasure.
Way, really? Way too late. I appreciate that. The baby's not there. What would you do? You'd be playing Call of Duty if not, right? Not doing Twitch.
I guess, well, the latest World of Warcraft expansion came out a few days ago, so I've been doing that.
I know you're a WoW guy. What is the new expansion? Is this the Battle for Azeroth?
That's it. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I've been waiting for the Battle for Azeroth.
I've been spending a little bit of time playing that for work. You know, I do gaming podcasts, so I had to. Obviously.
So is this... this
four
is,
consecutive days.
This is the world you go into, right? And there's other people. It's an MMORPG, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And so what is Battle for Azeroth? Is it new lands or what?
Just a quick disclaimer. I used to work for Blizzard a long time ago now, but I did, so... That's, you know, ethical statement. Yeah. But yeah, it's a new expansion. So usually what they do is that they add a new landmass, a new number of levels that you level through, and a new adventure, a new narrative thread that you go through. And this one is pretty good. They divide between the two factions of the game, the Horde and Alliance, and they give you two entirely different continents to explore. So the rivalry is very strong. And it's working. Narratively, it's pretty
well done. You like it. You're playing... So how many hours a week do you play World of Warcraft?
Well, when a new expansion comes out, it's usually all in for a few weeks. And in the past 4 days, it's been, I would say, can I say? It's been a few
little
hours
more.
A day.
A little more.
Yeah, a few hours a day.
What's your character? What's your main character?
I've been playing my mage, human mage, which I'm not super entirely satisfied with. I might go back to the druid, so we'll see.
Now, last time I played World of Warcraft, 70 was as high as you can go. This lets you go to 110?
120.
120?
Yeah.
Wow.
But they've been pretty clever. What they do now is that basically with every new expansion, they give you a character boost that brings you to the level you need to be at the beginning of the expansion.
That's smart.
So you don't need to worry about anything else. You just buy the expansion. And of course, pay for your subscription, right, which I'm guessing they hope you will forget about, just like, you know, every other subscription you have in your life.
So my level 12 thief, I could get in there and play. He's kind of weak.
You could boost it up to level 110 and nice. Start adventuring.
Oh, that'd be fun. So now we know why Elon's not getting much sleep. It was the battle for Azeroth. Duh. Patrick, tell us about French Spin. What should people do if they want to catch your work?
I do so many things. I guess I'm going to tell you about a couple of them. First, if you enjoy gaming, since we were talking about this, you can go subscribe to Pixels. It's a gaming news show, which I do every couple of weeks. With Gamescom coming up, there's going to be a lot of news. You can subscribe to the podcast called Pixels. And if you speak French or are learning French, what better way of practicing than listening to a tech podcast in French? That's Le Rendez-vous Tech. You can see it at frenchspin.fr, the French site for my podcasts. And I do a weekly show about tech in French. And that's an easy way of practicing this wonderful language.
Yeah. And the Phileas Club, too, where you talk about the news of the world.
The news of the world with lots of different people from different places. And that's often enlightening and depressing at the same time.
I didn't ask you, and I should have, what you thought about Fortnite on Android deciding to bypass the Google Play Store, which seems to me puts Android users at a little bit of risk in order to make a little bit extra money for Epic Games. You agree?
Yeah, it's very it's a complicated issue because Tim Sweeney, the CEO of Epic, has always had a strong stance against these stores that he feels, you know, kind of control the OS a little bit too much, and so he has a ground to stand on when he's saying this. At the same time, the 30% obviously is something that is difficult to swallow when your game is already the biggest thing in the world and you're probably going to get people to install it no matter what. The problem isn't so much that as what happens afterwards. Actually, Google did something really smart and really good for security. On the App Store, now they say, if you search for Fortnite, they say, we don't have the game on the App Store, so don't bother installing those other apps.
That's good.
It's not available.
Because there's a lot of free riders pretending they're Fortnite.
But I guess, you know, it's complicated because an open OS, obviously, you can let people install apps from wherever they want. But what we've learned is that it's safer for people if they're a little bit restricted. So I don't know. It's a tough one.
It is. Yeah. Thank you, Patrick, for staying up so late. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
And you know what? Thanks to Michael Nunez for staying up late. He's got a big work day tomorrow. Deputy tech editor of Mashable. He's at work right now. Thank you. Appreciate it, Michael.
Yeah, thanks. It's been a lot of fun. Obviously, it's not quite as late as it is in France, but it's the evening, and it's been a blast.
Good.
This is always, you know, always a good time.
Anything you want to plug? Any podcasts you're doing or anything?
We're working on a podcast weekly. It's called Mash Talk. That's run by my boss, Pete Patchell. What else do we have going on? Yeah, just some interesting reporting. You know, definitely check out Mashable Tech. I recently launched a little side project, a t-shirt shop that I'm kind of experimenting with for targeted ads. So you can check that out. It's called BrooklynVibesShop.com if you want. And what else? I don't know. I think really just stay tuned to Mashable Tech. I think like we have a couple of stories that I'm really excited about that we'll hopefully publish this week. And so hopefully you'll see those in the Twitter sphere. And if you like them, share them out and you know, follow all of our writers. They're you know, they deserve a lot more attention than they often get. So, you know, so give us some love. Yeah.
I want the Hecho on Brooklyn shirt. I like it.
Yeah, you found it. Yeah. So this is really it's a reason to you know, it's given me reason to just like experiment with a little more with targeted advertising and
do you do Instagram ads with this?
I do. Yeah, actually just started.
How's that working for you? Is it too early to tell?
It's too early to tell. I just started this weekend, but what I can tell you is that you can reach about 50,000 people for $30 in a span, like 5 to 7 days. The real question is how many people need to see a product before they actually click through and buy it. That's something that I don't have a firm understanding on, but I at least am getting a good gauge for how many people this stuff will reach for just a couple bucks. Right.
I'll tell you why I ask. For some reason, middle of the night, I'm on Instagram. I buy so much crap on Instagram.
It's honestly. So this
I don't know if it's because I'm weak because it's 3 a.m. or what, but.
I know. Yeah. It's becoming the, as seen for TV sort of marketplace.
It's my home shopping network. But key, and I don't know if you do this, it's got to be easy to pay. If I have to enter a credit card number, I'm not going to do it. But if it's got Apple Pay or Amazon Pay, some quick way of paying, you got me. I'll buy whatever crap you got on there.
Yes. Oh, that's exactly how I am. This shop has Apple Pay. I think I'll add Amazon Pay.
Pay is the worst thing that's ever happened to me. I bought a $2,000 electric bike with my fingerprint the other night. It's terrible.
Oh, that actually sounds pretty cool.
Oh, it is cool.
I agree with that one. I love biking. What I noticed was that I was seeing these shops pop up more and more, especially clothing. There's all these clothing brands that grow really quickly.
That's where I get my bamboo underwear.
Yeah, exactly. And for me, it's t-shirts usually, occasionally you get some weird stuff like, handmade sandals and all this other stuff. Gosh. I was constantly seeing this in my feed, and I just wanted to, it started as just kind of a fun project, and really it's just an open experiment. It's something for me to really just like, it's a fun side project, but I also am learning a little bit more about the ad tech. So it's been fun.
Throwboy, do you sell on Instagram? Throwboy is in the chat room. Roberto Hoyos, he makes amazing pillows. We have a lot of Throwboy pillows. I bet you sell in the Instagram. These are new. This is a Kickstarter.
Those are awesome.
Aren't they cool? 1977 Apple II, 1984 Mac pillow. I don't know if this Throwboy, do you still sell the Twit pillow? Because I bet you could sell a lot of those on Instagram.
Oh, nice.
That's where I got this one. Harry McCracken, the technologizer, technology editor, Fast Company. Plug something.
Oh, fastcompany.com always. I'm also rebooting Technologizer as a newsletter. If you go to newsletter.technologizer.com.
Oh, nice. Good.
I'm going to send out a new one in the next day or so.
Awesome. I've always loved that newsletter. Thank you for being there.
Legendary newsletter.
That means you're old, Harry. When the youngins call you legendary.
That is not what I meant.
Technologizer is 10 years old, by the way, this year.
Hey, that's nice.
Yeah,
it is
like
old.
One of the great tech newsletters.
Thank you, fellas. Really appreciate your being here. Thanks to all of you. We had a wonderful studio audience from all over the world, from Texas and Michigan and California, Australia, Washington State and Puerto Rico. Thank you all for being here. If you want to be in our studio audience, it's free. All you have to do is email tickets@twit.tv. We're in the Petaluma area, which is about an hour north of San Francisco. If you're going to be in Northern California, please come on and join us for a show. We do Twit every Sunday afternoon, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time. That's 2200 UTC. So you can actually watch us do it live. Get the unedited, unexpurgated version at twit.tv/live. If you're watching live, you probably should also be in the chat room because that's where everybody else is who's watching live. irc.twit.tv. You can also get on-demand versions of this show and every show we do at our website, twit.tv. Or maybe the best thing to do is subscribe. That way there's no problem. You just have it. It'll be ready for your Monday commute. The minute we've got it edited, we'll put it up on your phone or your device. You'll find us on every podcast application known to man. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time. Another Twit is in the can. Bye-bye. Doing the Twit.